the story of how the United States became a superpower at the head of a new global order and the invisible hands that guided it.
Listen first on BBC Sounds.
On FM, on BBC Sounds, and on your smart speaker, this is BBC Radio 4.
Hello, it's 6 o'clock on Monday the 31st of August. This is Today with Johnny Diamond and Amol Rajan.
The headlines: Andy Burnham is facing questions about his plan to release prisoners serving indeterminate sentences to free up space in jails. The Conservatives say they are still dangerous. We'll speak to the victims minister, the mother of a prisoner on an indeterminate sentence, and to a former Tory justice secretary. And the US and Iran have exchanged strikes in the first major military action for a month.
Also in today's programme, is the AI bubble about to burst? The Bank of England governor is sounding the alarm bell. What does that mean for us and for you? And in the last hour,
the volley from Djokovic. The forehand from Navone is down the line. It's brilliantly reached by the Argentine, who has become the first man in over 20 years to knock Novak Djokovic out in the first round of a Grand Slam.
Huge moment in modern tennis as Novak Djokovic has in the past hour lost in the first round of the US Open. Is it time for the tennis great to throw in the towel? And this Saturday night TV staple could be about to return to our screens. In case you're wondering, that was The X Factor. Does it have what it takes? The X Factor for the age of YouTube. The BBC News is read this morning by Alan Smith.
The Conservatives have warned that the government's planned changes to the early release scheme in England and Wales will still allow dangerous prisoners to be freed. The Prime Minister has excluded those convicted of unlawful killing, but wants to allow the release of some inmates being held under a policy known as imprisonment for public protection. Our political correspondent Jack Fenwick has more details.
Andy Burnham said yesterday that hundreds of prisoners previously eligible for early release would now be kept behind bars. One way he hopes to free up capacity on the prison estate is by releasing people on IPP sentences. Many have been let out at some point and then recalled to prison, but more than 800 have never been freed because of decisions taken by the parole board. The Shadow Justice Secretary Nick Timothy told the BBC the Prime Minister was stopping the release of some criminals by deciding to release others. He said the people who are still in prison on IPP sentences are dangerous, and expert assessors have concluded they are not safe to release. Mr. Timothy conceded that the previous Conservative government had failed to build enough prison spaces. The government is set to announce more details on its plans for early release in Parliament tomorrow.
The US says it struck two Iranian missile launchers on Larak Island in the Strait of Hormuz in the first known military action in a month. American officials say Iranian forces were preparing to fire rockets carrying sea mines into the waterway. Iran says it has retaliated by targeting US military personnel in the United Arab Emirates and in Jordan. Jordanian authorities say they intercepted eight missiles overnight. Our Middle East correspondent Yolande Nell reports from Jerusalem.
The US said it carried out a limited, precise action to protect trade and shipping after Iranian forces were observed getting ready to launch rockets with sea mines into the Strait of Hormuz. The US military had said it completed demining the waterway last week. Iranian media reported sounds of explosions near Larak Island, and Iran's Revolutionary Guard said several of its fighters and civilians were killed and injured. The guards vowed a response and punishment. Overnight, Jordan's armed forces said eight Iranian missiles were intercepted in its airspace.
Rescuers are pumping air into tunnels at a hydropower plant in Nepal as they try to reach hundreds of workers trapped by last week's flash floods. So far, there's been no sign of survivors. The disaster has claimed more than 900 lives in Nepal and more than 4,000 people are still missing. The United Nations says access to the affected area is difficult, with roads and bridges swept away. Laila Peters-Yahya is with the UN in Nepal.
Yesterday, I have sent colleagues into the epicenter. They still have not reached the places. So the access is going to be extremely difficult over the next few days, but we're very helpful. The government is doing its best to clear the road, but still to reach the places. And obviously, what we are worried about is more rain, also more flash floods.
At least 8 people have died and more than a dozen others are missing after a passenger ferry capsized and sank off the coast of northern Cyprus. The catamaran was carrying almost 270 people. Most have been rescued. The rabbi of Heaton Park Synagogue in Manchester, where 2 men were killed last October, has told the BBC the Jewish community there feels less safe now than it did immediately after the attack. Daniel Walker blamed rising anti-Semitism. A memorial service will be held at the synagogue this evening for the victims and survivors of the attack. Our special correspondent Judith Moritz reports.
Rabbi Daniel Walker said rising anti-Semitism combined with what he called a lack of action to deal with core problems had left many of his congregants, and British Jews more widely, feeling increasingly vulnerable. 2 men, Melvin Kravitz and Adrian Dolby, were killed and 3 others injured, trying to defend their synagogue. Tonight's commemoration will take place under tight security. A BBC Freedom of Information request to police forces in England and Wales has found that across 33 forces, violent hate crimes targeting Jewish people have risen by nearly 2/3 since 2022.
15 people believed to be missing after a flash flood in the Grand Canyon in the U.S. state of Arizona. The U.S. National Park Service said some tourists had to be airlifted to safety after heavy rain swept large boulders, footbridges and other debris into the Colorado River, which flows through the canyon. A woman who was forced to give up her baby for adoption says more support is needed for those affected by the practice, which was widespread in the UK in the decades after the Second World War. Marion McMillan says the trauma has stayed with her and is calling for dedicated help for women, children and adoptive parents. The Scottish, Welsh and UK governments have apologised for what happened. Our Scotland correspondent Lorna Gordon reports.
Marion McMillan was 17 when in 1966, unmarried, pregnant and shunned by her family, she was sent away to a mother and baby home to give birth. Despite begging staff to let her keep her baby, her son was forcibly adopted. An estimated 250,000 unmarried women across the UK were forced to hand over their children in a practice which was widespread until the 1970s. Marion McMillan is calling for a dedicated centre to be set up where anyone involved in adoption can receive training and support.
Stolen Babies is available to watch now on BBC iPlayer. And conservationists say an innovative scheme has helped save moorland in Greater Manchester from wildfire and flooding. The National Trust has been working with tenant farmers, the Environment Agency and the Ministry of Defence. It says peat embankments covered in vegetation have captured rainwater to re-wet the peat and help preserve it.
Thanks very much, Alan. It is 6:07. Let's find out about the weather on this bank holiday with Helen Willetts at the BBC Weather Centre. Good morning, Helen.
Hi, Johnny. Hello there. Good morning. Good morning at home. So we have had quite a bit of very welcome rain in the last few days, and the showers will continue to bring more welcome rain today. The likelihood is they won't be as widespread or indeed as intense as recent days. So for England and Wales, starting the detail, we still managed 25 degrees or thereabouts in Heathrow yesterday in between those showers, and it will be fairly warm today, 18 to 24 degrees Celsius. There are showers with us across East Anglia, across Northern England, across Wales, into the M4 region as well, across towards Bristol. So there'll be spray and standing water if you are heading out in the next few hours, but the showers are being driven in by quite a brisk west-northwesterly wind, which will transfer those showers eastwards during the day. So fewer showers further west under a ridge of high pressure building. So more dry and bright weather this afternoon, but still a few showers. Certainly so further east, and there could be the odd heavy one, even the odd rumble of thunder, but as I say, less widespread than yesterday. Northern Ireland also will see fewer showers, but it's an unstable atmosphere, so I can't rule out the odd one and not completely dry, but some dry weather, some sunny spells until late in the day, and the next weather front starts to appear off the Atlantic with some rain to come tonight. 18, I think, the high here. And it's a similar story for Scotland. We're losing the overnight showery rain into the North Sea now. Most of the showers will start in the west, transfer eastwards through the day, where they'll be heaviest in eastern Scotland this afternoon with the odd thunderstorm. Further west, fewer, a little bit drier and brighter, but some rain towards the Western Isles later in the day. 15 to 20 your high.
Helen, thank you very much indeed. It's 9 minutes past six. Let's have a first glance at the papers and websites this morning. Several of the front pages feature Andy Burnham's announcement that he'll make changes to the early release scheme in England and Wales. We're going to be covering this story at 7:30 and also 8:10, of course. The Daily Mirror says the decision to exclude those convicted of manslaughter from the scheme represents justice for loved ones and a relief for victims' families. But the Daily Mail believes that releasing some inmates serving indefinite sentences will mean the government allowing more dangerous criminals onto the streets. The Guardian picks up warnings that the plans could trigger further overcrowding in prisons and leave them one major event from disaster.
The Daily Telegraph highlights a letter from the Governor of the Bank of England, Andrew Bailey, saying that there could be a severe downturn in the global economy if the AI bubble bursts. The paper says he's told members of the G20 group of advanced economies that the soaring levels of debt used to fund the industry could trigger a potentially disorderly correction. We'll unpick that letter later in the programme.
Unpick and unpack.
They're both of them. We do the whole thing on this show.
We unpick and we unpack. The AI has spoken to a number of people caught up in the post office or a post office IT scandal who call on the Prime Minister to speed up the process of quashing their criminal convictions and paying compensation. The group of postmasters who were convicted using evidence from the faulty capture system, a predecessor to the now notorious Horizon software. They have told the paper that Andy Burnham should take a fresh look at the tortuous processes that they've been going through. The government said it was working hard to deliver for them as soon as possible.
Don't trust unqualified wellness influencers on social media is the warning from the NHS carried in the Times. It says a study has found nearly half the UK's population is spending more than £120 a year on health supplements promoted online. The NHS has told the paper that the use of products like magnesium for stress or collagen for anti-aging is not backed by good evidence.
Pictures of the young sons of one of the two police officers killed in a crash in Middlesbrough last weekend are on several front pages after they led out Manchester United for their match against Ipswich Town at Old Trafford yesterday. The Sun says they were united for Dad, while the Daily Star hails them as the bravest boys in Britain.
It is 11 minutes past six. After a month of quiet, military, if not rhetorical, there's been an exchange of attacks between Iran and the US overnight. Yolande Nell, our Middle East correspondent, joins us. Can you give us the detail, Yolande?
So, yeah, these were the first known US strikes since the end of July, with US forces striking two rocket launchers on Larak Island. That's a kind of small island in the Strait of Hormuz near to the port of Bandar Abbas, so overlooking shipping lanes at the mouth of the Gulf. The American Central Command said this was limited, precise action against an immediate threat because Islamic Revolutionary Guards were observed preparing to launch rockets with sea mines into the Strait of Hormuz. And this, of course, after last week, Donald Trump said that all mines had been removed or detonated from the strait, and Iran had been warned that any vessel placing new mines would be destroyed. Now, Iran's Revolutionary Guard said that several citizens and fighters were killed and wounded in this US attack, and quite quickly there was an Iranian response. State TV showed ballistic missiles being launched, saying that these were aimed at two US military bases in Jordan. The Jordanian armed forces have confirmed interceptions of 8 missiles in their airspace. And there's also been a report from Iran that they've also targeted a military base in the United Arab Emirates with drones. I've not seen any official comment on that yet, but the Iranian Revolutionary Guard spokesman saying this was a fatal mistake by the Trump regime during the economic war, referring there to the fact that we had just had this recent announcement from the Americans that there would be an economic D-Day, that they were going to switch away really from military options and be targeting Iran with economic pressure instead.
Yolande, thank you very much indeed. Yolande Nell, our Middle East correspondent.
13 minutes past six, at least 8 people have died and 18 others are still missing after a passenger boat capsized off northern Cyprus. The head of the Turkish administration there has said Ünal Üstel, the prime minister of the self-proclaimed Turkish Republic on Cyprus, said the ferry had been carrying 259 passengers, 8 crew members, when it began taking on water after departing from the coastal town of Kyrenia on Sunday. Our correspondent Hugo Bachega has been looking into the story. Hugo, it's a dreadful, dreadful tragedy, and sadly, as ever with these ones, it looks like those numbers are going to rise over the coming days. What do we know, if anything, about what happened?
Yeah, Amal. So what we've heard from the local authorities is that the ferry was hit by two waves before it capsized. And while the captain was trying to recover from the first wave, a second wave hit, and then the ferry began taking on water. And we've seen some dramatic footage. I'm sure you've seen those images as well, of passengers in life jackets on top of the overturned vessel as they waited to be rescued. Now, it's been almost 20 hours since this incident happened. We're still waiting to hear an update from the authorities, especially in terms of how many people have been rescued, how many are still missing. All night, friends and relatives of passengers waited outside the port in Kyrenia as the search for the missing continued. And this search included two helicopters. Divers were also involved in these efforts. So a huge search and rescue operation underway. Now, there's now an investigation. The captain and seven crew members have been detained as part of this investigation. But I think, obviously, the main focus right now for the families of the passengers in these crucial hours is trying to rescue people who could still be alive.
Hugo Bachega, good to talk to you. Thank you.
6:15, we mentioned that exchange of fire between Iran and the US. Well, oil prices are back above $90 a barrel, reflecting that renewed fighting, just as finance ministers and central bankers from the world's biggest economies gather in North Carolina. Leanna Burns here with the Business News. Good morning, Leanna.
Good morning, Johnny, and also good morning, Amal. Yeah, that's right. And also shares have fallen across Asia. With us now is Shanti Kellerman, Co-Chief Investment Officer at Seven Investment Management. Good morning, Shanti.
Good morning.
So quite a lot for markets to absorb this morning. What are investors most worried about here?
With Iran, I think it's that we could go back to continued hostilities. This has actually been the first conflict we've had since July, even though it's been in the news quite a bit. So we've seen oil jump. And we also had the news over the weekend about the U.S. taking over reserves from Venezuela. The market didn't really move in response to that, though. I think it's a long time to develop the actual plans to get oil out of Venezuela.
We're going to talk about that in a minute as well. Well, that elevated geopolitical risk is also the backdrop to another big issue facing finance ministers at this G20, how countries pay for much higher defence spending. The UK is committed to increasing core defence spending to 3.5% of GDP by 2035 from around 2.6% at the moment. And Canada is among the countries pushing for a new Defence Security and Resilience Bank. That's a proposed international bank which could raise money and provide financing to governments and defence companies. Britain hasn't committed to joining it so far. So Shanti, can you explain how that bank would work?
Sure. It'd be similar to something like the European Development Bank or the World Bank or IMF. You'd have a bunch of countries that are members commit capital to the bank, and then it would be set up with staff and a mandate and rules and a purpose, and it would go out and lend money. And in this case, it would be lending money to defense companies, defense projects, defense procurement, most likely related to the nations that are contributors to it. So the hope is it could put a bit more capital and a bit more money into that ecosystem and help fund some of that development.
And do we know why Britain hasn't committed to joining?
So there's a couple things. You know, we obviously have to ask the government, but what we've seen in the news is, you know, A, the cost. They're asking for $1 billion in capital, which is, you know, not the biggest thing in our budget line, but not nothing either. There's also the issue of once you put your money into that bank, it's an institution, it's other people deciding where it goes. So you do give up an element of control. And then the other part of it is a lot of the reason you do these arrangements is that you might be able to get a lower borrowing cost in by doing this than you could just by borrowing money through gilt. But when you look at who the other members are for this, you might not actually be able to get that lower cost.
Okay, well, with us now is Andy Thomas, CEO of Cohort PLC. That's a UK listed group of defence technology companies. Good morning, Andy. Is access to finance actually the problem for you, or is it getting governments to make those decisions and actually place the orders?
Well, it's very much getting governments to make those decisions and place the orders. In fact, access to finance for us is pretty good. I wouldn't say that's necessarily the case for smaller defence companies and startups. But what we're seeing is a significant contrast between other European countries where we're seeing, you know, significant order intake and the UK where everything's going fairly slowly.
Why do you think that's the case?
I think it's a combination of factors, but one is moving from releasing the defence investment plan, into sort of turning that into a precise plan for expenditure and projects over a period of time. That seems to be taking a while. Another might be a shortage of experienced commercial staff. That seems to be a bit of an issue in terms of bringing in contracts for us.
Well, the government did finally publish its defence investment plan. Has that improved things for you at all?
The truth is actually not significantly so far, although I'm optimistic that it will now that there is at least a funded plan in place. But it's not made a difference over recent months. Mm. I mean, contrasting, for example, I mean, we recently were awarded a contract of something about 140 million euros from Saab to supply the sonar system for the new submarines that Poland is acquiring. We're seeing much less of a sense of urgency from the UK. So, for example, we're seeing long delays on equipment that we expect to be providing for the Batch 2 of the Type 26 frigates and in renewal of some long-term service contracts as well.
Okay. Andy Thomas, CEO of Cohort PLC, a UK-listed group of defence technology companies. Thank you so much for joining us. And a government spokesperson told us the first duty of government is to keep its citizens safe. The Prime Minister and Chancellor committed to fully funding the defence investment plan. At the spending review, we will set out a pathway to meet our NATO commitments at 3.5% of GDP on defence by 2035 and will set a target date to hit 3% on that path. Now, we're talking about governments looking for new ways to finance much higher defence spending, and part of that reason that matters is because borrowing money has become considerably more expensive. And in the US, markets are still digesting Kevin Warsh's first Jackson Hole speech as Federal Chair Reserve on Friday. Shanti, you're still with us. What did investors hear from that speech?
So there was a bit more clarity on what does he actually think about the economy. He said that he thinks, you know, the US is in a good place in terms of the level of unemployment, but that inflation isn't meaningfully falling. The market reacted by putting a bit higher probability that we'll get an interest rate rise, because if inflation isn't falling naturally on its own, you might need action by those central banks to help bring it under control.
And given that jump in oil prices this morning, does that make that hike even more likely?
Yeah, it probably does. And when you looked at the probabilities, it went from about a 35% chance of a rate rise this month to 65%. And you saw the short-term bonds, so bonds with about 2 years, go up about 0.1%.
And you mentioned this earlier, Shanti, Donald Trump announcing what he called a huge oil deal with Venezuela, giving the US access to more than 65 billion barrels of its proven reserves. Now, on paper, that sounds enormous, but how much of a difference will that actually make?
I think it'll make very little difference in the short run until they can show that execution is possible. So they'll need a company to come in and do the work to excavate oil. And if you think about, you know, having a company be willing to go in and invest billions and billions, what's the risk? You know, what happens to this deal once Trump leaves office? What happens if the Venezuelan political situation changes and they want control back of their country? Those are going to be all really high hurdles for any country that's going to go in and do those investments. Venezuela has really thick, heavy crude, and it requires a lot of expensive, energy-intensive methods to get it out. So it would take a while.
Okay. Shanti Kalman, Co-Chief Investment Officer at Seven Investment Management. Thank you so much. Now, millions of people have been taking a break in the UK over the bank holiday weekend. Visit England estimated but 10.6 million Britons were definitely planning an overnight trip, potentially generating £4.3 billion in spending. But while the amount was forecast to rise, the number of people travelling was expected to fall. Russell Imrie, President of Best Western Hotels in the UK, is calling the government to cut VAT for the sector while it waits for business rates reform. He started by explaining why he believes hotels need help now.
What's important now is that hotels are not overlooked again. Hotels were left out when additional business rates relief was given to pubs. Despite hotels facing many of the same pressures and in many cases significantly higher fixed costs than pubs, the hotels in general were not included in that business rates relief. Going forward, the government needs to give hotels some breathing space while the work is done on this business rates revaluation. Nothing's going to come through inside 3 years, and that is a huge length of time for a hotel to continue to face these economic headwinds. A reduction in VAT would be a simple yet effective lever to help operators protect jobs, support investment, put money back into businesses, etc. But the government seemed to be deaf to this constant request for the VAT rate for UK hospitality to be equal to the VAT rate in European hotels.
What happens after the summer peak for Best Western hotels? Once the bank holiday is over and people aren't necessarily doing as many staycations, what's your outlook?
I think the winter months, or the, shall we call them, the off-season months, will be challenging. We've got the increase in energy prices coming through with the increase in the price cap. It's just constantly tightening of the belt with consumers. And I think it will be a very tough and difficult next 6 months from, say, October onwards for the leisure segment.
Russell, when you say tough, do you mean that your member hotels, are there any at risk of closing?
Yes, there are hotels at risk. A very significant Scottish-based hotel company, with one hotel in Harrogate and one hotel in the Lake District, went into administration this week. That was a hotel company with 8 hotels. These are hotels with 90 to 100 bedrooms. Businesses are fragile and there will be casualties going forward. But hotels are very resilient. They will do what they can and they will cut back themselves. They will reduce staffing. They will reduce investment. But that can have an impact on the number of young people being employed. It can have an impact on the quality of the product, because if you're not spending money on carpets and curtains and beds and furniture and decoration, the quality of the product can go backwards.
Previously, you've spoken about the Edinburgh visitor levy and you said hotel industry's concerns, they were ignored over that 5% levy. So it's now been applied to stays since the 24th of July. Is there any measurable effect that you've seen in your hotels there?
There's no measurable effect at the moment on number of customers, because it was only introduced on the 24th of July. So we're very, very early in the day. Some customers are arriving not realizing that they're going to have to pay a visitor levy. But where it has having a huge impact, and we warned about this policy of applying a percentage to the room rate is having a disastrous impact on smaller businesses. They just are not coping with the administration. And I would not be surprised going forward if there are going to be many, many accommodation businesses within Edinburgh who are just not able to manage the administration of this. It would have been so much simpler for both the business and for the customer if we did the same as everywhere else in Europe and we just applied an amount of money on top of the room per night.
I mean, the proceeds are meant to support the culture, the events, the public services that actually attract the tourists. So maybe that would actually benefit hotels.
There's no faith that all this money raised on the visitor levy is going to be ring-fenced for the visitor economy. The city's finances are understandably under stress, and the city see this visitor levy as a source of funding for day-to-day expenditure. Yes, some will be spent on the visitor economy, but some of it will go off to normal day-to-day city expenditure.
That was Russell Emery, President of Best Western Hotels in the UK.
Thank you very much indeed, Leanna. It is 26 minutes past six and Jonathan Ledgard is here with a big moment in modern tennis history, Jonathan.
You're right, because on the opening day of the US Open tennis, have we seen the end of an era?
The volley from Djokovic, the forehand from Navone is down the line. It's brilliantly reached by the Argentine, who has become the first man in over 20 years to knock Novak Djokovic out in the first round of a Grand Slam.
So no 25th Grand Slam title for Djokovic. The Serb is out, beaten by Argentina's Mariano Navone in a match lasting 5 sets, nearly 5 hours. So that means correspondent and commentator Russell Fuller is still up watching. Morning, Russell.
Hello, Jonathan.
What happened? Because it was a painful watch, wasn't it?
It was very painful, quite literally, for Novak Djokovic, who had a medical timeout before the final set. He took more painkillers. He had a back massage. His shoulder was causing him problems. He'd already vomited multiple times in this match. He had considered retiring, but he won the second and third sets and went an early break up in the fourth. But after that, things ran away from him very fast as the world number 49 played superbly to close out the match 6-2, 6-1 in those final two sets. Djokovic has been dealing with an underlying health condition this year, which is particularly challenging in hot and humid conditions like tonight. And he said afterwards that he really did despise most of his time on court. He's going to go away and try and fix the problem if he can. No suggestion he's throwing in the towel career-wise just yet, Jonathan.
No. And then now you're still watching another Grand Slam champion, Venus Williams, and she's in trouble too.
She is in trouble, but is fighting back against Sofia Kenin, another wild card and a fellow Grand Slam champion from the United States. Williams lost the first set 6-2, was a breakdown in the second, but they're now level at four games all. Williams at 46, outside the world's top 600, is trying to end a run of 14 consecutive defeats. And sympathy for both of these players who were asked to start this match ludicrously at 13 minutes past midnight, the latest ever start in US Open history.
Wow, more from Russell and Novak Djokovic in an hour's time. In contrast, 23-year-old British qualifier Toby Samuel won his match, first match at a Grand Slam. He beat the former world number 20 Thomas Mahac in straight sets in little over 90 minutes. Also through to round two in New York is Katie Bolter, but the British number two, Cameron Norrie, was knocked out. Joe Root told his England cricket team to celebrate like grown-ups after wrapping up a first series win in almost 2 years yesterday at Lord's. They won the second test against Pakistan by 194 runs. And in football, a hat-trick by Bruno Fernandes inspired Manchester United to a 5-1 home win over Ipswich. The United team was led out by the two sons of a police officer killed in a crash on Teesside. They led them out as mascots for the match at Old Trafford. PC Matthew Blaise described as a proud red by United. He was a regular at Old Trafford.
Thanks very much, Jonathan. It's 29 minutes past six, and throughout this coming Thursday, Radio 4, including this programme, will be looking at the impact of the Norman Conquest.
Norman Day on BBC Radio 4.
The Bayeux Tapestry revisits the UK after almost 1,000 years.
It's a symbol of friendship between the two countries now.
To chart this landmark occasion, we're taking a day to examine the enduring legacy of the Norman Conquest.
How does this connect with what I'm speaking right now? Are these words I'm saying mostly English, mostly Norman French, or what?
Looking at linguistics, food and culture.
Norman influence is all around us, from our landscape to our architecture.
Norman Day.
This Thursday on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
And as one of the day's highlights, the Financial Times' political editor, George Parker, will explore why the tapestry is as political today as it was in the 11th century. The power of the Bayeux tapestry, next Thursday afternoon at 4:30.
It is 29 minutes to 7. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Johnny Diamond and Amol Rajan. Here's a summary of the news from Alan Smith.
The Conservatives say the government's planned changes to the early release rules in England and Wales could still put the public at risk. The Prime Minister has ruled out releasing prisoners convicted of unlawful killing, but wants to make some inmates serving imprisonment for public protection sentences eligible for release. The US says it's carried out its first known military strike against Iran in a month, hitting two missile launchers on Larak Island in the Strait of Hormuz. Washington says Iranian forces were preparing to fire rockets carrying sea mines into the waterway. Iran says it has retaliated by targeting US forces in the United Arab Emirates and Jordan. It also said that an oil tanker had caught fire near the Strait of Hormuz after hitting two naval mines. Rescuers in Nepal are trying to reach hundreds of workers trapped underground at a hydropower plant following last week's devastating floods. Air is being pumped into tunnels, but there's been no sign of survivors. More than 900 people have died in Nepal and more than 4,000 remain missing. The United Nations says getting aid into the worst hit areas remains difficult because roads and bridges have been destroyed. The rabbi of Heaton Park Synagogue in Manchester, where two men were killed last October, has told the BBC the Jewish community there feels less safe now than it did immediately after the attack. Daniel Walker blamed rising anti-Semitism. A memorial service will be held at the synagogue this evening for the victims and survivors of the attack. At least eight people have died after a passenger ferry sank off the coast of northern Cyprus. More than a dozen people are still missing. The catamaran was carrying around 270 people, most of whom have been rescued. And police say they made 169 arrests on the first day of the Notting Hill Carnival in West London, but that the mood had been overwhelmingly positive and celebratory. The carnival attracts around 2 million visitors and is marking its 60th anniversary.
Alan. Forgive me. Is it me or you, Johnny?
Forgive me. I think it's you, and that was my mistake.
You were trying to steal my thunder. I was going to thank Alan. You could thank Alan if you like.
Your thunder.
Alan, thank you very much indeed, and indeed, Johnny. It is 27 minutes to 7. Newspaper front pages this morning, a light on the issue of the early release of prisoners. It is happening because prisons are basically full. We're going to come back to this story at 7:30 and 10 past 8. Let's turn now to Ian Watson, our political correspondent. Ian, morning. This is a case of the government having to choose between bad and worse options, isn't it?
In a word, yes. Andy Burnham makes his first statement as Prime Minister to Parliament tomorrow. The new Justice Secretary, Alex Norris, will also be making a statement specifically on the early release of prisoners. And how the Conservatives are characterising this policy is that the government is keeping some dangerous criminals in jail for longer by letting other dangerous criminals out. What they mean by that is that those on indefinite sentences, which date back before the year 2012, may well become eligible for release, or some of them, in order to free up prison capacity. But they're there basically for public protection. So the Conservatives are saying actually there needs to be a proper debate on this, there needs to be emergency legislation. And certainly if the government does decide to get people out of jail who've been there for 14 years or more, they're going to have to introduce some legislation. It's not something they can do instantly. So a lot of the questions are going to be asked about how quickly can capacity be freed up, because by keeping people such as PC Harper's killers in jail for longer, people convicted of manslaughter, for example, or death by dangerous driving, then in effect, the government is going to, we think, we'll get the exact figures tomorrow, but probably keep around 1,400 people in prison who otherwise would not be eligible for early release. But I think I should make this point, though, as well, Amal, and that is that however difficult the questions are for Andy Burnham tomorrow, they would have been far more difficult if PC Harper's killers, two of them, had been allowed out of jail early. So, yes, he is choosing between far from ideal options, but I think he's choosing, at the moment, for him at least, the one that's less politically toxic.
Which is what so much of politics is about, isn't it, Ian? Thank you very much indeed, Ian Watson.
It's 25 to 7, 6 days on from the glacier collapse in Nepal, and the authorities there say that more than 900 people are dead, as many as 2,500 missing. More than 900 of them are thought to be employees of the country's hydropower sites, trapped in the tunnels they were building when the huge surge of ice, water and debris changed the landscape around them. Our World Affairs correspondent Joe Inwood has pulled together some of the stories of the weekend gone.
High up in the hills, a group of soldiers gingerly make their way to a rough-hewn entrance in the rock face. Soon, torches are needed. As they approach what appears to be a collapsed wall, this is part of a hydropower plant, utterly destroyed by the floods, its tunnels now thought to imprison hundreds of workers. Nepal's Foreign Secretary, Amrit Bhadur Rai, says getting them out is now a top priority.
Our immediate national priority remains clear: to save lives, locate missing persons, rescue them. In coordination with the Nepali army, some tunnel rescue experts from India, China and Republic of Korea have been also mobilized especially to rescue the persons trapped into the tunnels.
Some of the workers have already been brought to safety, dragged and carried through mud so thick it left rescuer indistinguishable from rescued. One of them was an engineer called Saddam. Now safely back in the capital, Kathmandu, he knows many of his friends will not make it.
Friends who we worked with are missing. We've not been able to contact them, and I feel really bad for them.
The rescue is still ongoing. Oxygen is being pumped into the tunnels. Nepal is in desperate need of good news. Some came in the form of a head teacher who is said to have led hundreds of children to safety. This is the sound of an entire school making their way up steep slopes, still in their uniforms. A man in a blue t-shirt hurries them along. Below them, the sound of rushing water as their entire community is destroyed. This was filmed on Wednesday morning by Unisha Amatya and shared with the BBC's Nepali service.
My friends and I only made it by 10 seconds. The floods came all of a sudden. I couldn't walk fast, and my friends helped me to climb uphill. Within no time, the bazaar was swept away in front of my eyes.
Leading them was their head teacher, Rajendra Dawadi. He had received a call from a friend telling him the flood was coming and decided to evacuate the school.
It is emotional. I feel proud that we managed to save so many children. If we had waited 10 minutes, all of us, including the students, wouldn't be here to speak to you today.
Now safe on higher ground, the children continued filming,
helicopter, helicopter,
seemingly excited about the next part of their rescue. But this is a country currently digging mass graves and taking DNA samples from unidentified bodies. With heavy rain continuing and thousands still missing, for Nepal and Tibet, there is not yet light at the end of the tunnel.
That was Joe Inwood, our World Affairs correspondent. Let's get the latest from our correspondent, Azadeh Moshiri, who is in the Rasuwa district, one of the worst affected areas in Nepal. Azadeh, thank you very much for joining us. Can you just paint a picture of what you see, what you've seen, how the area looks?
Right now, I'm in Sonobarku, which is a village, as you said, in Rasuwa. And I'm actually at a point that a lot of villagers come to, they gather, because you get a very, very good view of the Bhotikosi River, which flows from Tibet through Nepal. And for the people here, it's a very shocking sight, because in the distance, you see one lone building, and all around it is completely barren. There is only rock and mud. And yet that used to be a village. So people come here to stare because they're in disbelief. You can also see the entrance, the mouth of a tunnel, the Chilimeha Power Tunnel. It is one of the many tunnels where hundreds of people are currently missing across northern Nepal. In this one, eight people are still missing and believed to be trapped. But even the director of the hydropower tunnel project has said that he doesn't believe anyone there will be saved. And as I've been walking around Dunge, Dunche, and Sonobarku and these other villages in the area, helicopters, you might be able to hear one now, keep passing above, because those rescue operations are continuing. There's still hope that there will be survivors who are found. Thousands have been found so far. But unfortunately, in this village, everyone I speak to will tell me that they have lost loved ones or have some missing. And if I ask them whether they have any hope that they'll be found, that hope right now in this fifth day of rescue operations is gone. And at this point, the authorities have told us that there are at least 903 people who have been killed and more than 4,200 people who are missing. And so those sorts of figures, those numbers, and just the fact that they haven't been able to see their loved ones, it's they're in disbelief.
I mean, leaving aside for a moment, you know, the terrible numbers of dead, the people who are missing, the living, the people that you are talking to must be terribly traumatized by the experience and the continuing fear that the waters could come again.
Yes, I mean, as you know, everyone processes grief quite differently. Some people will in shock by what they've been through, especially people who, for example, have returned to their homes. That two people I met the other day had gone back to their town looking for the people that they'd lost and had just saw houses that were empty and covered in mud. That experience and having survived that when their loved ones didn't is obviously very traumatic. But then you'll just see some who are just, they haven't processed that grief yet. And it's such a shared experience in an area like Rasuwa that they're sort of focusing on picking up the pieces. And in these villages here, they don't have electricity. They're relying on generators that they're using very sparingly. And this is the area very close to the border with Tibet. They rely on trade, especially when Nepal's autumn festivals come up. It's an area that thrives on tourism. And so they're traumatized by what they've been through. They're also confused as to what the future holds for them as well.
Azadeh, you mentioned that some of the hydropower workers who we think have been trapped in the tunnels have, you know, that the authorities are saying, look, we don't think they're going to make it. There presumably is a fairly significant focus on the others that could be rescued, because there are so many who are missing.
There are. I've met relatives of tunnel workers, some of whom are very angry. They feel that more should be done. I was at the army barracks 2 days ago, and relatives started fighting and yelling at the army. Obviously, again, it's the full range of emotion, this grief, shock, and anger. But there are ongoing rescue efforts. The Prime Minister has insisted that emergency workers are doing all they can. India, which has a lot of experience with these sorts of tunnel disasters, has sent its own team of experts. So has China. In one hydro tunnel in particular, Trishuli and 3A, there are a team of 90 rescuers who are pumping air, hoping that if there are any survivors in there, it could help. But so far, they have heard anything from the workers trapped inside.
Azadeh, thank you so much for sharing your experience with us. Thank you for that. Azadeh Mashiri there, apologies for the slightly choppy line. You can imagine the communications are all over the place coming out of Nepal.
It is 16 minutes to 7. Teacher retention is a crisis and we need urgently to make life and work better for those teachers. This is the view of the Liberal Democrats, who say their own research, not independently verified by the BBC, suggests that nearly half of teachers are planning to leave the profession in the next 5 years, and three quarters feel frequently or constantly burnt out at work. What to do about it? Well, Caroline Vodin is the MP for South Devon and Liberal Democrat schools spokesperson. I asked her to spell out the problem.
Well, clearly workload. We did a survey, a national survey, and over 932 teachers responded, and the results were really stark. Almost half, 48% of teachers said they were considering leaving in the next 5 years, and workload was the main reason for that. The job is just unsustainable, particularly for teachers who have families and young families.
The trouble is with that stat, which we've not independently verified, that at the same time, maybe the two things can be reconciled, but the National Foundation for Educational Research has repeatedly said quite the opposite. It said the Department for Education has made progress towards achieving its target of recruiting 6,500 teachers, supported by improving retention rates and more people entering teacher training in recent years.
I think recruitment is one thing, but you can recruit as many teachers as you like. But if teachers are leaving the profession at the rate they currently are, then it's not going to make any difference at all. And certainly our evidence ties in with a project done by an organisation called Maternity Teacher, Paternity Teacher, who looked at how many teachers were leaving just after coming back from maternity leave, and they also stressed unmanageable workload as the reason for wanting to leave. I mean, 9,000 teachers left the profession in 2023. So there really is a crisis looming, and we as a party are calling on Lucy Powell to address this urgently at the top of her inbox as the new Secretary of State for Education. Because if she doesn't implement a serious package of measures to address the retention crisis, then schools will be hitting a point of no return that they won't be able to manage.
What do you think that package should look like? Is it as simple as more money, or are there other things that she could offer?
Well, this isn't really about money. We're calling for three things. So we want the government to fully fund the teachers' pay rise, which comes into effect in September. The National Education Union estimates that not fully funding that pay rise will have costs of $460 million across the sector. And what that means is that school support staff, admin, learning assistants will be the first to go, because the salary budget is the highest budget in any school. And every time you lose a teaching assistant from a classroom, you're putting more pressure on the classroom teacher. So that's one thing. We're also calling for a maximum working hours for teachers. So they are contracted to work around 32 and a half hours a week. That's enshrined in the school teachers' pay and conditions document, but it's rarely enforced, and they're expected to do lots of additional hours on top. And the average hours that teachers were working in our survey was 54 hours a week, which is way beyond what most people would consider to be a full-time job. It's just unsustainable. So this is about including their marking, their planning, their prep time in their working hours, and really getting a grip on the additional hours that teachers are expected to work. And the third thing is that we want all schools to be offering some form of flexible working to teachers to make the profession more manageable with other family commitments. And the government has just released guidance on flexible working, but it's not mandatory. They're not compelling schools to do it, and they're offering very little support in how to create a flexible working policy. So we want to see much more action on that.
Isn't there a potential dividend for schools from the fact that we've got sharply falling pupil numbers, basically because we've got people having fewer babies? I mean, the percentage of the pupil population is going to fall over 6 years by about 6%. Isn't that potentially going to make things easier?
Could potentially make things easier. I mean, school rolls are falling. Certainly at the primary school level, we're seeing class sizes reduce. That's not going to impact secondary schools for some time to come. And we still need all those expert teachers in lots of different subjects in secondary schools. Mm. So it's not that straightforward. You know, class sizes might go down from 30 plus to just under 30, but you're still going to have just as many classes.
All right. Caroline Vodden from the Liberal Democrats, thank you so much for joining us.
It's 11 minutes to 7. A united Ireland is inevitable, the former Prime Minister Gordon Brown suggested to the Guardian newspaper over the weekend, something that probably came as news to the current Prime Minister, who said in the preceding week that a border poll, a vote on unifying Northern Ireland and the Republic, was off the table. In the deal that saw the guns decommissioned and the institutions that we now have in Northern Ireland established, the Good Friday Agreement, there is a provision for a poll on the border if majority opinion changes within Northern Ireland. Professor Jonathan Tongue is British and Irish politics professor at the University of Liverpool, author of the 2024 Northern Ireland election study. Good morning.
Good morning.
What is public opinion now in Northern Ireland?
Public opinion in Northern Ireland suggests that if you average across opinion polls and surveys, 48% of Northern Ireland's population want Northern Ireland to remain in the UK. So not an overall majority, but it is a lead, a quite substantial lead, over those who want a united Ireland, which again, averaging across polls and surveys, is at 38%. You've got 14% who say they don't know, which is actually bigger than the percentage gap of 10 points between the two sides. So there's still a majority for the union. You wouldn't say it was the most secure majority ever, and it has fallen substantially since Brexit. If you go back to opinion polls that were done pre-Brexit, the percentage saying they wanted Northern Ireland to remain in the UK tended to be in the 60% plus range. So there's been a drop in support for the union, but the union is still preferred to Irish unity amongst most people within Northern Ireland.
We should remember there is another country that has a say in this as well, and that is the Republic of Ireland itself. Where is opinion there?
There's always been a majority in favour, whichever poll you use, a majority in favour of Irish unity. The depth of support for Irish unity might be questioned, because when caveats are added, such as the potential for higher taxes to pay for a united Ireland, support tends to fall away, albeit it still remains just about majority support. It's also very low, a united Ireland, on the priorities of electors in the Republic. But there is majority support there for a united Ireland. So I suppose, you know, the sum of the parts might, you know, encourage Gordon Brown to offer that quote of saying it's inevitable, a united Ireland, which is a surprising quote, it has to be said, for someone who fought so hard to defend the UK as it is in the Scottish independence referendum. But it does recognise, as you indicated in your introduction, you know, Northern Ireland is an explicitly conditional part of the UK. Yeah. It only rests in the UK on the basis of majority consent, which is there at the moment, but might not be there in perpetuity.
And Jonathan, people point to the changing makeup of the population of Northern Ireland, the increase in the number of Roman Catholics against Protestants in particular, the fact that Sinn Féin are the largest party, and they say, you know, this is the way the wind is blowing. Is that an inevitability, given the way that the population is changing, the political makeup, or do those who want unification need to find another group of people to get support from?
Yeah, the term inevitable is surprising, but there has been demographic change, substantial demographic change within Northern Ireland. Catholics do, as you say, outnumber Protestants now, and most Catholics back a united Ireland. So that demographic change is significant. Add it to political earthquakes like Brexit, and you have seen a closing of the gap between supporters of Irish unity and supporters of Northern Ireland remaining in the UK. That gap is likely It's not certain, but it's likely to continue to close. So at some point, we could get a border poll. I think that Sinn Féin's call for one by 2030 is entirely unrealistic. It's, the gap's certainly not going to close at that pace. But by 2040, possibly later, a border poll is a possibility. But even Mary Lou MacDonald, as president of Sinn Féin, has said a united Ireland is not inevitable. We have to work for it. And the people that Sinn Féin and others who want a united Ireland have to work on, the group, are those don't knows, the sort of people who are constitutionally agnostic in Northern Ireland, which is a substantial proportion of the population, many of whom vote for the Alliance Party in the middle in Northern Ireland, who don't take a position on the border. They have to be won over, those people who are indifferent, apathetic about a united Ireland, or simply haven't made up their mind yet.
Professor Jonathan Tong, thank you very much.
7 minutes to seven. Should Annie Burnham approve new oil and gas drilling projects in the North Sea? And if he does, how can their climatic effects be mitigated? Well, Miatta Fanbullah, the Energy Secretary, is due to give a decision on the Jackdaw gas field and Rosebank oil field next month, September. Two candidates for the leadership of Scottish Labour interestingly backed those licences this weekend. Professor Miles Allen is the head of atmospheric, oceanic and planetary physics at the University of Oxford and was one of 160 climate scientists or environmentalists to sign an open letter to the government on how to make any new licences more environmentally attractive. And Professor Allen joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
Oh, very nice to hear from you. To be clear, you don't take a view on whether the licences should be approved, but rather, if they are, then about the conditions to attach. And I think, Professor Allen, your main recommendation is about carbon capture and storage. What is carbon capture and storage?
Well, in a nutshell, it's carbon dioxide disposal. At the moment, private companies get a license to take fossil fuels out of the ground. They sell it. It's ours when it's under the ground, after all. They sell it to us for a healthy profit. And then it's sort of up to us to deal with the consequences. And what we're saying is that seems wrong. These companies, if they are going to have a license to take fossil fuels out of the ground, should take on an obligation to dispose of the carbon dioxide, which the use of those fossil fuels will inevitably generate. That means capturing the carbon dioxide, either ideally where it's generated, but if not necessary, back out of the atmosphere, purifying it and putting it back underground where it came from.
So you'd put the onus on the fossil fuel industry to deal with what I think economists call negative externalities, and you'd like to see upscaling.
You can call it negative externalities, or you can call it just cleaning up.
Yeah, yeah.
It's simpler than just paying a carbon tax or something. It's just, if you're going to sell something that causes global warming, it's up to you to fix it.
And you'd want this to sort of scale up. How do you propose it would scale up from, say, 10% in 2030 to rising by 2040 and so on?
Well, if we want the fossil fuel industry to be aligned with the goals of the Paris Agreement, so limiting global warming to well below 2 degrees, then we need to achieve geological net zero. So we need to have the flow of carbon dioxide back into the Earth's crust has to balance any continued production of oil and gas by or soon after mid-century. So the fraction of the carbon dioxide that we permanently get rid of in this way has to go up from around a thousandth at the moment, so it's tiny. It has to go up to 100% by mid-century, so we better get going now. And that's essentially what we're saying in this letter. They could aim for 10% by the mid-2030s. It wouldn't really affect the profitability of these fields. And crucially, it would show the world how to align oil and gas developments with the goals of the Paris Agreement. Britain... We started this process fossil fueled warming, so it's up to us to show the world.
And it's sometimes said, Professor Allen, that Britain could be a world leader in this technology, in carbon capture and storage. Is that realistic?
Absolutely. We've got fantastic geological resources under the North Sea in the very rocks that we got the oil and gas from in the first place. So, and we've got all the technology to do it. And if we establish the principle that it's up to the fossil fuel producers to get rid of the carbon dioxide generated by the products they sell, then, and if we persuade our neighbours, incentivize our neighbours to do the same, then we can sell this technology to other countries to stop fossil fuels from causing global warming.
Okay, Professor Miles Allen from the University of Oxford, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
This weekend, Radio 4 takes a journey through an education revolution.
Grammar school or secondary modern, For generations of children, the 11 plus exam would determine their future. But in 1976, a law was passed to make all state secondaries comprehensive. Selection was out and the classroom was to be transformed.
The deliberate aim is to create classes that are mixed in ability and social background.
Equal opportunities for every child was the goal. But 50 years on, did reality match the ambition? I'm Lucy Kellaway, journalist turned teacher. I'll be charting the evolution of comprehensive education and exploring the tensions and challenges facing today's schools. Comps, this Saturday evening at 8 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
2 minutes to seven, here's the weather with Helen.
Thank you very much indeed, Amal. So we've still got low pressure with us for this bank holiday weekend for many, not for all, of course. And that means more showers, but not as many or as heavy as we've had through the rest of the weekend. So for England and Wales, we've got one or two showers starting to bubble up. They're mainly across Wales, across the West Country, but that band will transfer eastwards as we go through the day, and there'll be some heavier outbreaks in those showers further east this afternoon. Possibly a rumble of thunder, but as I say, not as extensive as the weekend. And further west, we've got a ridge of high pressure building, which will do two things. It will decrease the shower activity, increase the amount of dry, bright and sunny weather, and ease the breeze, because the breeze is going to be fairly gusty across southern and eastern areas, at least for the first part of the day. Temperatures 18 in the west, 23, 24 in the east. Northern Ireland will see fewer showers as well. We've got a band in the east at the moment. As they move away, it'll be drier, brighter, fewer showers. But later in the day, we'll see some rain coming towards Fermanagh and Tyrone. So 16 to 18 here. And finally to Scotland, the showers are out in the North Sea. The next band's in the west, which will transfer eastwards through the day. There could well be some thunderstorms in eastern Scotland this afternoon, but still 20 between those, 15 or 16 further west.
Thanks very much, Helen. You are listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Amal Rajan and Johnny Diamond.
It's 7 o'clock on Monday, the 31st of August. The headlines. Andy Burnham is being warned that his changes to the early release scheme could mean some high-risk offenders are allowed out of prison. We'll speak to the mother of the kind of prisoner who could be freed and to a former Justice Secretary about whether this is the right move. For the first time in a month, there has been fighting between the United States and Iran. The number of people missing after the flash floods which hit Nepal last week has jumped to more than 4,000.
Also coming up in the next hour, is it the beginning of the end for Novak Djokovic?
The volley from Djokovic. The forehand from Navone is down the line. It's brilliantly reached by the Argentine, who has become the first man in over 20 years to knock Novak Djokovic out in the first round of a Grand Slam.
Djokovic out in that first round of the US Open for the first time. Is it time for the tennis great to call it a day? And a new trial, the first of its kind, suggests that women who've had treatment for breast cancer may not need a lifetime of medication for their hearts. But first, the BBC News with Alan Smith.
The Conservatives have warned that the government's planned changes to the early release scheme in England and Wales will still allow dangerous prisoners to be freed. The Prime Minister yesterday excluded those convicted of unlawful killing, but said he would allow the release of some inmates being held under a policy known as imprisonment for public protection. The Shadow Justice Secretary, Nick Timothy, says ministers must now allow their plans to be properly scrutinised, as our political correspondent Jack Fenwick reports.
Andy Burnham said yesterday that hundreds of prisoners previously eligible for early release would now be kept behind bars. One way he hopes to free up capacity on the prison estate is by releasing people on IPP sentences. Many have been let out at some point and then recalled to prison, but more than 800 have never been freed because of decisions taken by the parole board. Nick Timothy told the BBC the Prime Minister was stopping the release of some criminals by deciding to release others. He said the people who are still in prison on IPP sentences are dangerous, and expert assessors have concluded they are not safe to release. Mr. Timothy conceded that the previous Conservative government had failed to build enough prison spaces. The government is set to announce more details on its plans for early release in Parliament tomorrow.
The US military says it struck two Iranian missile launchers on an island in the Strait of Hormuz in the first known military action in a month. American officials say Iranian forces were preparing to fire rockets carrying sea mines into the waterway. Iran says it has retaliated by targeting US military personnel in the United Arab Emirates and Jordan. The price of Brent crude oil has already jumped 2%. Our Middle East correspondent Yolande Nell reports from Jerusalem.
The US said it carried out a limited, precise action to protect trade and shipping after Iranian forces were observed getting ready to launch rockets with sea mines into the Strait of Hormuz. The US military had said it completed demining the waterway last week. Iranian media reported sounds of explosions near Larak Island, and Iran's Revolutionary Guard said several of its fighters and civilians were killed and injured. The guards vowed a response and punishment. Overnight, Jordan's armed forces said 8 Iranian missiles were intercepted in its airspace. The latest exchange of fire comes just days after the Trump administration said that it was shifting to tight economic sanctions rather than military options to try to end its war with Iran.
Iran's Revolutionary Guard say an oil tanker has caught fire near the Strait of Hormuz after hitting 2 naval mines. In a statement, they said the rogue supertanker was attempting to pass through the waterway illegally. The United Nations has warned it's still extremely difficult to access the parts of Nepal worst hit by last week's flash flooding. Officials say a total of 900 people are now confirmed to have died. Rescuers are going through debris looking for the more than 4,000 people who are missing, including over 900 trapped in tunnels that form part of hydroelectric power stations. Our South Asia correspondent Azadeh Mashiri reports from the town of Dunche.
Rescue efforts continue with helicopters passing over us every few minutes. Those across northern Nepal that have survived the flood are now picking up the pieces. Here in Dunche, residents are living with pockets of electricity and relying on generators. Nearby villages were swallowed by floodwater, leaving many people displaced and living in camps. One man told us anyone you speak to here will know dozens of people who have died. Meanwhile, a team of 90 rescuers have been pumping air into the Trishuli 3A hydro tunnel, hoping to save the workers trapped inside. The crew has blasted a hole in the crown of the tunnel, and rescuers have descended on ropes. But the Prime Minister has said so far they've received no response. India and China, which have experience with tunnel rescues, have sent their own experts to help.
15 people are believed to be missing after a flash flood in the Grand Canyon forced the evacuation of dozens of campers and hikers. The US National Park Service said some tourists had to be airlifted to safety after heavy rain swept large boulders, footbridges and other debris into the Colorado River, which flows through the canyon. The rabbi of Heaton Park Synagogue in Manchester, where 2 men were killed last October, has told the BBC the Jewish community there feels less safe now than it did immediately after the attack. Daniel Walker blamed rising anti-Semitism. A memorial service will be held at the synagogue this evening for the victims and survivors of the attack. Our special correspondent Judith Moritz reports.
Rabbi Daniel Walker said rising anti-Semitism, combined with what he described as a lack of action to deal with core problems, had left many of his congregants and British Jews more widely feeling increasingly vulnerable.
Looking back, I think we're actually almost in a harder position than we were even immediately after the attack. I think the sense of vulnerability has grown. It hasn't diminished.
2 men, Melvin Kravitz and Adrian Dolby, were killed and 3 others injured as they tried to defend their synagogue from an attacker on the holiest day of the Jewish year, Yom Kippur. A wave of worldwide anti-Semitic attacks followed over subsequent months. Today's commemoration will take place under tight security. A BBC Freedom of Information request to police forces in England and Wales has found that across 33 forces, violent hate crimes targeting Jewish people, such as harassment and assault, have risen by nearly 2/3 since 2022.
The Conservative MP Dame Priti Patel has announced that she's leaving her role as the Shadow Foreign Secretary. In a post on social media, she said she was taking up an international role for the party. The BBC understands she's set to be replaced by Tom Tugendhat. Conservationists say an innovative scheme to rapidly re-wet peat on upland moors has helped to protect against both wildfires and flooding. The National Trust has been working with tenant farmers and bodies including the Environment Agency and the Ministry of Defence to restore hundreds of acres of land in Greater Manchester. Rebecca Drought reports.
On top of the moor at Holcombe near Manchester, the ground stayed wet this summer, despite the heat waves. The National Trust believes this was thanks to a scheme to build more than 3,000 scallop buns, semicircular peat embankments covered in vegetation that capture rainwater. The first time such a technique's been used at this scale on upland. The pools and boggy ground created have helped support wildlife and allowed sphagnum moss, which holds huge amounts of water, to be restored. Experts say it could take 50 years for the moor to fully recover, but the bund technique could be used elsewhere to provide natural flood management, encourage wildlife, and make the land more resilient to fire.
An 85-year-old actor diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease 2 years ago is returning to the London stage this week. Peter Marinka, who has spent decades working in theatre, radio and films, including Love Actually. Now he's revisiting a role he first performed 40 years ago, with all the profits going to the Alzheimer's Society. Our health reporter Jim Reid has more.
A few years ago, Peter Marinka says he started switching off on stage. An MRI and other tests followed and he was diagnosed with Alzheimer's. That has not stopped him performing. This year, he was offered the lead in Crap's Last Tape by Samuel Beckett, an intense one-act monologue.
I was thrilled and I thought, to do it again is always to do it better, maybe. Yes, and it's a swan song.
People with Alzheimer's typically experience memory loss. To support Peter, teleprompter screens will be dotted around the theatre and he'll be wearing a tiny earpiece so he can be discreetly fed a line if needed.
In men's tennis, Novak Djokovic has suffered his earliest Grand Slam singles exit in 20 years, losing in the first round of the US Open. The 39-year-old was in tears during his five-set defeat to Argentina's Mariana Nivone and said he considered withdrawing from the match.
Thanks very much, Alan. It is 9 minutes past seven and overnight there's been military action in the Gulf, the first really in a month or so. Strikes by the US against Iranian launchers the US says that were preparing to send rockets with sea mines into the Strait of Hormuz. Iran's response, a volley of ballistic missiles sent towards US bases in Jordan. Those missiles brought down by air defences. The Strait of Hormuz remains the focus of much attention. It is, of course, a fuel and fertiliser choke point. The US has been working to reopen it, Iran to maintain its grip. A fair few ships now are trying to move through the strait without advertising their presence, so it's become a lot more difficult to estimate how many ships are getting out. Earlier I spoke to Joel Rayburn, a retired US Army officer, former National Security Council official, now at the Hudson Institute Research Group. He oversaw the development of the first Trump administration's Iran strategy.
This is the latest salvo in a campaign in which the Iranian regime is trying to hold on to its ability to disrupt the global oil economy. And the United States and its allies are working very hard to rob the Iranians of that strategic leverage. And it looks like the U.S. side is gaining the upper hand there. What happened in the back and forth military confrontation was that just a few days ago, the U.S. Central Command announced that it had been able to clear the main shipping channels in Strait of Hormuz of any Iranian mine threat. Immediately after that, it seems like within the last 24 hours, the Iranians tried to deploy additional mines there after the U.S. had warned that if the Iranians did that, the U.S. would respond militarily. And so the U.S. conducted airstrikes against the forces, the Iranian forces that were trying to deploy the mines. And then the Iranians fired 8 ballistic missiles toward bases in Jordan that were hosting U.S. forces or that U.S. forces were using, all of which were intercepted, shot down without doing any damage.
So you see this rather than an eruption of a new phase in hostilities after a period of relative quiet. You see this as the United States sort of repressing Iran's ability to reestablish control over the Strait of Hormuz. Is that how you understand it?
Yeah, I think, yes, that's exactly how I see it. Because what's happened over the last month or so is that the oil volumes that have been quietly exiting the strait under U.S. Guidance, protection, if you will, have gotten to the point where there's very little deficit in the global in global oil supply. And that's exactly what the Iranians can afford.
It is a significant reminder that America is prepared to act militarily to protect its interests and global interests against Iran. And of course, that the war, whilst quiet, is not over.
That's true. It's also a reminder, I think, of the weakness of the Iranian position, because at the same time that oil production, oil exports have ticked back up slowly, gradually, almost toward pre-war levels or within enough range of pre-war levels that the deficit can be made up in other regions of the world or by releases from strategic reserves elsewhere, the Iranians are exporting next to nothing. Their cash flow is severely disrupted. The U.S. naval blockade is preventing them from being able to generate the revenue stream that they need just to run their state and to keep the war effort going for an extended period of time.
We did see an Iranian response. We saw attacks on two, or attempts to attack two U.S. bases in Jordan. Will that draw a U.S. response, or will that be already anticipated by the US when it launched its attacks on those seeking to remine the Strait of Hormuz?
Well, it could draw US response, but I would say, considering the fact that, I mean, it was a pretty meager attack. Eight ballistic missiles, the Jordanians reported, all of which were intercepted, shot down, did no damage. I don't think President Trump would feel compelled to respond when essentially they blocked the shot, if you will.
Yeah. Joel Raybon, thank you very much for your time.
Time now is 14 minutes past seven. The Children's Commissioner is backing calls for parents of children with serious physical or mental health conditions to receive 12 weeks of paid parental leave at 90% of their normal pay. The idea is that you can provide immediate financial security following a diagnosis or major deterioration in a child's health. It's become known as Hughes Law because Hugh Menai Davis died in 2021 at the age of six. He had cancer. Kerry Menai Davis is the father of Hugh Menai Davis and has been campaigning for Hugh's Law and joins us now. Kerry, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks so much for joining us on the programme. Just tell us what Hugh's Law is, would you?
Hugh's Law, in effect, is similar to that of maternity leave and paternity leave, where employers and the government recognises that a parent needs to be by the bedside of their child when they need to care for them. And should that same child be 2, 3 years old and sadly diagnosed with cancer like Hugh was, at the moment, parents do not have a legal right to be by the bedside of their child, to leave work and do what any parent would do, to be with their child. And Hughes Law, in effect, would protect parents for up to 12 weeks so they can just down tools and go and be with their child and do what really matters most and be a parent at the most harrowing time of your life.
Tell us the reality of what happens at the moment, i.e. in the absence of Hughes Law, what did you and your family have to go through when you found out that your little boy was very, very ill?
Oh, sadly, Hugh was diagnosed in 2020, so we started his first chemotherapy day on the first day of the second lockdown. And so we spent 6 months isolated during his major treatment, but we witnessed parents, in effect at that time, being paid to be by the hospital bed with furlough, which was around at that time. But when COVID started lifting, the restrictions started lifting, we watched parents trying to navigate the workplace in the hospital room next to their child, taking Zoom calls, reports, writing reports, being pressured by bosses whilst, you know, on the other side of the screen, their child is receiving life-saving treatment. You know, chemotherapy makes you violently sick sometimes and other things that go along with it. And, you know, I hear parents daily talk to us about losing their homes, maxing credit cards out, families splitting up because they can't deal with the pressures of the finances that goes along with a sick child. And, you know, in a society where we're supposed to be helping people, the most vulnerable, I think this is one of the things that we can really target.
given what you've been through, Kerry, it might seem like the height of rudeness to put this to you, but some people in government or in business might be listening and thinking it, so I will. What would you say to those businesses who say that they can't necessarily afford it, they're working on tight margins, a lot of pressures already, and indeed those people in Whitehall, who I know you're speaking to regularly, who say, look, it is just the fact that public finances are incredibly tight at the moment. We haven't got that much spare cash, even for the nice to have things like this.
Well, I'll put it on the business. I'm a business owner myself. What I would say is that if that parent is or has a diagnosis of a sick child, they're leaving no matter what you say. And they're going to be doing what they are supposed to be doing as a parent and be by the bedside of the child. But the actual cost of rehiring someone far outweighs the cost of offering this as an employment right. We know that there's statistics that say it can be up to £25,000 to employ someone new. That includes rehiring fees, adverts out in recruit magazines, and the lack of productivity. When in reality, the cost of doing this for 12 weeks is around £2,244 to the employer initially, but it would fall under the same mechanism as maternity statutory leave, where it's repaid up to a certain point by the government. And so what happens is then you can retain your workforce. Your staff have a good feeling that you are supported by your employer. And also the cost of not doing this versus the cost of doing it on the welfare state and the NHS is huge, because these parents who lose their everything at that point in the child's diagnosed, they're going to be claiming welfare in the future. Yeah. They're going to be claiming benefits, everything, you know, mental health deterioration. If we don't intervene early, and by intervening early, we can prevent, you know, the claim of everything further down the line.
So in other words, if you pay a bit up front, you could save further down the line. All right, Kerry Menai-Davis, campaigning for Hughes Law in honour of your late son. Thank you very much indeed.
18 minutes past seven, and it is Tim Cook's last day as the CEO, the boss of Apple. After 15 years in the job, he will hand over the reins to John Ternus tomorrow. Leanna Byrne has more. Hi, Leanna.
Hi, Johnny. Yes, Tim Cook took over from Steve Jobs back in 2011. And since then, Apple's market value has shot up more than tenfold, from around $350 billion to roughly $4.7 trillion today. Tim Baharin has been an Apple analyst for more than 40 years and is the founder of Creative Strategies, a research company based in Silicon Valley. He joins us now from California. Hi, Tim.
Glad to be with you. Thank you.
So 15 years on, what do you think Tim Cook's biggest achievement at Apple has been?
Well, a couple of things. One, when Steve died in 2011, but the company itself actually took a shock because of Steve's leadership and his death. But Steve had done such a good job preparing Tim to become the next CEO. He spent 10 years prepping Tim to take over, that the actual transition from Steve to Tim went very, very smoothly. And Tim then led them to the next big thing, which was the Apple Watch, and then the advancement of all the new Apple iPhones going forward. Mm. And as you said, you know, when Steve died, Apple's monetary value or valuation was around $350 billion.
Mm. But do you think it's a fair criticism of Cook that he was exceptionally good at growing the company rather than actually creating the next great Apple product?
Well, you could argue both ways. I mean, to be honest, I think if I was an investor, I'd be thrilled that he basically grew the valuation of the company and, more importantly, the earnings and the ability to, you know, bring money back to their investors. Yes, in the sense that it would have been nice for him to have had some other breakthrough products. But to be fair, it's following the iPhone was such a major product that had dramatic impact on all of us. Repeating that was at least a tough challenge.
Now, Tim Cook, he isn't disappearing. So how much freedom do you think Ternus will really have to put his own stamp on Apple, because Tim Cook is becoming executive chairman?
Actually, I think Ternus is really going to have the majority of all of the decisions on his shoulder. As Tim has said, he's going to be kind of a diplomat in a sense. He remains as the chairman, And he will be the face of the company in some of the things, especially in relationships with government and political scenes, etc. And that frees Turnus up basically to just run the company. He doesn't have to worry about that.
All right. Tim Baharin, Apple analyst for more than 40 years and founder of Creative Strategies. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much indeed, Liana. It's 22 minutes past seven. This week we'll see the unveiling of the Bayeux Tapestry at the British Museum. The first time that the 70-metre-long artwork has been in the UK in almost 1,000 years. To mark the occasion, we're going to be broadcasting from the museum on Thursday morning as part of Radio 4's Norman Day. And in the run-up, we wanted to ask some familiar voices for their reflections on the tapestry and its depiction of the most famous battle in British history. Here's the classicist, Professor Dame Mary Beard, who's also a trustee at the British Museum, describing what stands out to her.
One of the things that stands out for me, and it's a very obvious classical thing to say, is it's full of Latin, right? And it's full of wonderfully easy Latin. So anybody can go and look at the Bayeux Tapestry and they can see bits that they can translate, even if they haven't done Latin for years or never did it very much. You know, things like, hic Harold Rex interfectus est, you know, here Harold the King is killed. So I partly think of it as a wonderful example of medieval Latin still being in use. When I went to Bayeux, it was then, in fact, that I noticed all the different things that were going on in the borders of the tapestry, which suddenly take you to a world that is quite at variance with the battle scenes. You know, people ploughing, animals, people having fun, little representations of fables. It's as if it's a reminder that war is blotting something out. There are all kinds of questions you have about women's lives that are raised by the tapestry, including the very curious and I think still mysterious figure of what Elfgiva, or whatever she's called. What is she doing on the tapestry? Although it is a very blokish work of art in some ways, not in terms of its who produced it, but in terms of the characters, it doesn't overlook the victims and the female victims of war.
Quite. Well, thank you very much indeed to Professor Dame Mary Beard. And as I say, we're here from the Anglo-French author Joanne Harris on the programme tomorrow, and we will on Thursday be broadcasting from the British Museum.
It's 24 minutes past seven. One of the downsides of some life-saving breast cancer therapies is that they can weaken the heart, and that's why many women are told to stay on heart medication for life. But a new trial, the first of its kind, suggests that a lifetime of medication may not be necessary. A weight may be lifted from many, many women. Lucy Shepherd was diagnosed with breast cancer when she was 33, and her treatment caused cardiac dysfunction, for which she took medication. She took part in the trial. She told us about the benefits.
Not having to take medication now as a result of taking part in the trial has really given me a lot of freedom. I now feel as I did before I had experienced cardiac dysfunction. I feel, you know, completely healthy. I feel it's taken all of the worry away. I don't feel concerned now if I feel tired or out of breath that something bad's happening. And just makes me feel as I did before, which is, you know, with especially having received a diagnosis of cancer, you know, there are so many parts of your life that change forever. And I feel like it's just one less thing to worry about. It's really given me so much freedom.
Well, Professor Charlotte Manistee is Head of Clinical Cardiovascular Science at University College London, Consultant Cardiologist at Barts Heart Centre and University College Hospitals London, who led the trial. Good morning, Charlotte.
Good morning.
Your trial involved, 90 women across four hospitals. What did you find?
Yeah, so this was a study funded by the British Heart Foundation where patients were either randomised to come off their heart medications under close monitoring or to continue them. And what we showed is that actually by 12 months, heart function stayed stable, and only one patient who stopped their medications had a deterioration in their heart function. And importantly, that was picked up on the scanning before she had any symptoms. And once she was restarted on the medication, her heart function recovered to normal. What we also saw was that actually patients reported an improvement in their quality of life, as Lucy has just discussed, showing that it improves their life by coming off these medications.
I mean, it does rather beg the question as to why so many women were on heart drugs following the therapy for so long. And was it simply caution because the therapy was known to risk heart problems?
Yeah, so it's a difficult area where we didn't have the evidence previously, but also perhaps more importantly, in other types of heart failure due to other causes, it's been shown that stopping those medications leads to a recurrence of problems. And as a result, the evidence really is extrapolated from that population. But obviously, this is a very different scenario. In this scenario, we've got a cause, i.e. the cancer treatment, and once that's stopped, and the heart has improved back to normal again, it suggests that it may be safe to stop the medications.
You could hear the sort of relief in Lucy's voice and in the testimony. And presumably, if you're going to take women off the medication, you will need to maintain some kind of monitoring.
Yeah, that's really important. So this is the first evidence, really, that stopping these medications might be an option. And it really opens the opportunity for a kind of proper personalised conversation between the patient and their doctor about whether you can stop these medications. Mm. But patients must be monitored closely. And please, I'd recommend that you don't stop medications on your own. You need to talk to your doctor before you can even have a conversation about this.
So what is the next step? You've done the trial. How does it move now?
Yes, yeah, so it's a small trial, obviously, and we definitely need more evidence before this becomes part of routine practice. Everybody in the trial is being followed up for 5 years. We need larger, more diverse trials. And we also need to understand who can and who can't stop therapy and get better predictors of that. But this really is a first step, and it's an important one. It's the beginning of the story, really, not the end.
Professor Charlotte Manistee, thank you so much for joining us.
It is 28 minutes past seven. Here's Jonathan with a sport.
Good morning. It hasn't taken long for the US Open to deliver its first big shock.
The volley from Djokovic, the forehand from Navone is down the line. It's brilliantly reached by the Argentine, who has become the first man in over 20 years to knock Novak Djokovic out in the first round of a Grand Slam.
Yep, Djokovic down and out, beaten by Argentina's Mariano Navone in a match lasting 5 sets and nearly 5 hours. In fact, everything about the match was painful for Djokovic, as correspondent Russell Fuller has just been telling me.
Yes, a miserable night for Novak Djokovic, a very humid night in New York, and Djokovic losing in 5 sets in 4 hours and 36 minutes, having led by 2-1 and a break in the 4th set, but his body gave up on him. And in a medical timeout before the final set began, he had a back massage, he took painkillers, his shoulder was causing him problems. He'd already vomited multiple times during the match and was in tears at one point. And Djokovic losing in the first round of a Grand Slam for the first time since the Australian Open of 2006. And this problem he has, a health condition which he first revealed, Jonathan, in Cincinnati earlier this month, particularly affects him in hot and humid conditions. And Djokovic spent a few minutes talking to the media afterwards as he came off the court and said that he pretty much despised every moment of the match.
An awful feeling on the court for me. It's something that I've been carrying, unfortunately, pretty much every match this year. Vomiting, throwing up, serious issue there. And then my whole body, starts to collapse, basically.
Is this the end then for him as a Grand Slam performer? Is he still going to keep going for that Grand Slam 25 so elusive?
I think he probably will keep going. I've felt for quite a while that him winning a 25th Grand Slam title is probably unrealistic, but he certainly feels he can still win a Grand Slam, and he was the runner-up at the Australian Open at the start of the year. However, 39 now, this underlying health condition which is causing him further problems, and you do wonder if losing in the first round of a Grand Slam does take some of the enjoyment away from the experience. But if you listen to the way he talks, Jonathan, Jonathan, on a regular basis. He still loves the challenge. He loves being on tour. And he's talked about playing for Serbia in the LA Olympics of 2028.
And what about Venus Williams? She also lost. Is this the last time we're going to see her at a Grand Slam?
Well, she has been the recipient of many wild cards in 2026. This was her 12th, and she's now lost 15 singles matches in a row. I have to say, she performed very well against Sofia Kenin, who is also a Grand Slam champion and much younger than she is. She very, very nearly took that to a third set in a match which started at 13 minutes past midnight, but Kenin saved 7 set points to win in straight sets. Williams seems to want to continue her career, but certainly you do have to wonder whether it is right to continue to give her wild cards, even though she's achieved so much as a 7-time Grand Slam singles champion when she's not able to record any victories.
Russell Fuller, who is in fine form today, and he'll be back again, BBC Sounds, tomorrow for day two, or later today even. Better news of the 23-year-old British qualifier Toby Samuel. He won his first match at a Grand Slam, beating the former world number 20 Thomas Mahatch in straight sets. Katie Bolter also through to round two. Cam Norrie out, though. Meanwhile, ahead of last night's Premier League football match between Manchester United and Ipswich at Old Trafford, the United players were accompanied onto the pitch by two very special mascots.
This afternoon, under the grey skies of Old Trafford, the children of PC Matthew Blades, one of the two policemen tragically killed in that accident in Middlesbrough last weekend. He was a proud Red and a devoted family man. His wife is here today, along with the two children, who've walked out with the Manchester United captain and goalkeeper, with, I'm sure, their dad watching on.
And United went on to win the match 5-2, and the captain, Bruno Fernandes, scored a hat-trick.
Thanks very much, Jonathan.
What has the BBC ever done to open our eyes to the world?
Well, it's taken a deep dive into the world of AI.
I don't think anyone really understood what would happen when hundreds of millions of people started using this new technology.
Shared strong opinions from across the country.
Welcome to Question Time. Our audience reflects the general political picture across the nation.
And asked even more difficult questions with Louis Theroux.
You know, because there's a lot of toll that comes with being in the public eye. Do you keep an eye on that?
There's a BBC for each of us, funded by all of us. This is our BBC.
Well, coming up after the news, the Prime Minister is being warned that his changes to the early release scheme could mean some high-risk offenders are left out of prison. We'll speak to the mother of the kind of prisoner who could be freed and to a former Justice Secretary about whether it's the right move.
You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Amol Rajan and Johnny Diamond. It is 26 minutes to 8. Let's get a summary of the news with Alan Smith.
The Conservatives say the government's planned changes to the early release scheme in England and Wales could still put the public at risk. The Prime Minister has ruled out releasing prisoners convicted of unlawful killing, but plans to make some inmates serving imprisonment for public protection sentences eligible for release. The Shadow Justice Secretary, Nick Timothy, says those still in prison on IPP sentences are dangerous and that expert assessments have found they should not be released. The US says it has carried out its first known military strike against Iran in a month, hitting two missile launchers on Larak Island in the Strait of Hormuz. Washington says Iranian forces were preparing to fire rockets carrying sea mines into the waterway. Iran says it has retaliated by targeting US forces in the United Arab Emirates and Jordan. It also said that an oil tanker had caught fire near the Strait of Hormuz after hitting two naval mines. Rescuers in Nepal are trying to reach hundreds of workers trapped underground at a hydropower plant following last week's devastating floods. Air is being pumped into tunnels, but there's been no sign of survivors. More than 900 people have died in Nepal and more than 4,000 remain missing. The United Nations says getting aid into the worst-hit areas remains difficult because roads and bridges have been destroyed. 15 people are believed to be missing after a flash flood in the Grand Canyon forced the evacuation of dozens of campers and hikers. The US National Park Service said some tourists had to be airlifted to safety after heavy rain swept large boulders, footbridges and other debris into the Colorado River, which flows through the canyon. And the rabbi of Heaton Park Synagogue in Manchester says the Jewish community there feels less safe now than it did immediately after the attack last October, in which two men were killed and three others were injured. Rabbi Daniel Walker has blamed rising anti-Semitism. A memorial service for the victims and survivors will be held at the synagogue this evening.
Alan, thank you so much. It's 24 minutes to 8. What to do about Britain's prison population, which is bursting? With just a couple of thousand places left out of an overall population of 87,000, the government has to choose between a range of pretty bad options. Where it's got to is that it will be releasing some prisoners who are on what's known as imprisonment for public protection sentences, or IPP. The way it works is once a minimum term has been served, the prisoner can be released only once the parole board is satisfied that they no longer need to be confined for public safety, meaning many are being held indefinitely. Ministry of Justice data suggests that 2,271 people were serving IPP sentences. 856 of those have never been released because the parole board thought it was not safe to do so. The government's going to table legislation to terminate the sentences, it says, by the end of this parliament. Shirley De Bono is a campaigner and the founder of the IPP Committee in Action. Her son, Sean Lloyd, was 18 years old when he was convicted of a street robbery in 2006, so 20 years ago, and he was handed an IPP, this imprisonment for public protection. When he was released after 8 years, as with other IPP sentences, he was placed on indefinite licence, but he's since been recalled to prison 5 times, most recently earlier this summer. Shirley joins us now. Shirley, good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate your time. Have you spoken to your son, Sean, who I think now is 38? Have you spoken to him about the possibility of his being released under this new scheme?
Yes, I have spoken to him about it, but they've had so many letdowns in the past, they don't really believe it unless anything happens.
Sure. And just tell us why Sean is in prison. So he's been recalled for things like repeat drug offences, and it's more that he's not obeyed the sort of terms of his release rather than, again, performing violent crimes. Is that right?
Yeah, he's never committed a violent crime, since he got the IPP in 2006. He's not going to any trouble like that. This recall was totally unfair. He's been drug-free for over 2 years. He was actually on an apprenticeship to work on railway lines with 2 more weeks to go. An anonymous phone call came. The first we knew of it was when the police knocked my door to do a welfare check on me. And apparently the anonymous phone call said that Sean had strangled me, which was a total untruth lie. And they were quite happy. I was fine. They left. And then next minute, Sean is recalled back to prison.
So why has he been, just help us understand, why has he been recalled to prison several times then, Shirley?
He did come out of prison the first time with a drug addiction, of which I was unaware of. Because he'd been let down so many times with the parole boards, there came a time when he put a sheet around his neck and he was going to hang himself. He came really close to that, but he didn't do it. And that was when he became addicted to Subutex in prison, advised by another prisoner to make his days shorter and to progress to his next parole hearing.
Right, because everyone listening to you, Shirley, will understand that must have been unimaginably painful for you as Sean's mum. And I guess the argument you're making is that, you know, it's better off for Sean because prisons are terrible places for people to be in for lots of reasons. It's better for him to be outside of prison on an apprenticeship getting work. But what would you say, Shirley, to those who listen to you and say, here is someone who went to prison at the age of 18 and has been recalled back many, many times and who are worried about their safety and think the best place for someone like Sean is behind bars?
No, the best place for Sean right now would be home with his family. The apprenticeship, he can go back to apprenticeship. He can continue with that. He can go in straight into work, guaranteed work. You know, he's got a place to live. He really rehabilitated himself on the last recall. He became drug-free. He was never allowed to become drug-free. When he wanted to go cold turkey on the outside and come off the drugs, he was told, If you don't comply, Sean, you will be returned back to prison. So he was never allowed to come off the prescription drugs. So this time, the last time he was recalled, while he was inside, he thought, I may as well get clean. They can't recall me. I'm already in prison. And he came out clean, doing really well, got himself an apprenticeship, was going to the gym, you know, he was bonding with his children again. And next minute, all I was stolen away from him.
Final quick thought, if I may, Shirley, before I turn to Sir Robert Buckland. What would your message to Andy Burnham be this morning?
My message to Andy Burnham would be, We know that there's going to be some sort of announcement on Tuesday, and we're hoping that legislation will be changed to enable the sentence to be ended. We don't know what's going to change, but an example would be if they're going to release the test case of the parole board, reverse that, then what we need is for the Prime Minister to give us a date. You know, we okay. need a time frame. These prisoners need a time frame because they're living in limbo. You know, they never know when a parole board is until the last minute. They don't know if they're going to get out of prison or not. We need a time frame.
A time frame and some... And some certainty. Mm-hmm. Okay, Shirley, thank you very, very much indeed for joining us this morning. Appreciate your time. Let's turn to Sir Robert Buckland, the former Conservative Justice Secretary. Sir Robert, good morning.
Good morning.
What do you make of Shirley's case, which you heard there? Because there'll be some people in the public obviously understand as in a compassionate way the pain of a mum. Others who say that the best place is for her son to be behind bars.
Yeah, look, I mean, cases like that one where you've got return to prison because of failures to comply with the licence, I think are quite different from cases where people are returned to prison for after the commission of further serious offences. And the truth is that each case will vary on its own facts. And it's going to require, I think, quite painstaking work by civil servants to look at each individual case. The truth is that just under 1,000 people remain in prison on IPPs, having never been released. And the majority of them are in for very serious offences. Mm. You know, they're not in for stealing a loaf of bread. They're in for serious violent and sexual offences. And therefore, there is a public protection element that remains. However, that number is dwarfed now by the people who've been recalled. The recall figures, I think, are about 1,200 or 1,300, which is more than the number of people who've never been released. And it seems to me, looking at those recalls, looking at the circumstances, working out what packages can be given to support people back into the community is the way that we're going to crack this particular nut.
What would you be doing right now if you're Justice Secretary on this issue?
So I'd be looking at all the cases again. And sifting out the ones like Sean's from the ones where clearly people are still a real, real danger to the public and working out how many more we can get out. I don't think we should be resentencing these prisoners. I think that sets a quite an alarming precedent. You know, the important thing about sentencing is there should be certainty. One of the reasons why this particular type of sentence was abolished was that it did create uncertainty, not just for the prisoners, but actually for the victims and their families, not really knowing when it was that these people were going to be released. And I think there was a very good policy reason why they were abolished. But trying then to retrofit sentences that were passed off many years ago is, I think, a perilous task.
And final thought, Sir Robert, what do you think about where the government has got to?
Well, look, I think the government have inherited a scheme that was put together without real thought for the political and justice consequences. The numbers are now reduced, and I welcome that. But there will still be anomalies. And I'm sure once we hear the announcement from the government tomorrow, there will be other families saying, well, hold on, you know, why is this class of prisoner not being released and yet other serious offenders are coming out of prison? The problem will remain.
Well, we're going to speak to the government at 8:10. So Robert Buckland, the former Conservative Justice Secretary, thank you.
16 minutes to 8. The ground on Holcombe Moor, north of Manchester, stayed nice and moist this summer as so much of England and Wales baked and dried and some of it burned. The National Trust says it's down to the success of their scheme to create thousands of peat embankments, or scallop bunds, as they are known. An added bonus to the nice wet peat is that they then act as something of a firebreak. Ben Eardley is the National Trust Nature Recovery Project Manager. Morning, Ben.
Morning.
This is about the reshaping of the peat, is it? So reshaping it so that it holds water?
Yes and no. It's about reversing the impacts of how that peat's been historically drained. So the buns that you mentioned are a way of helping to retain the water in that peat. And then additionally to that, the National Trust has planted a huge amount of sphagnum plugs. Sphagnum is a moss, and that helps to retain the water as well. So what you're looking to do is reduce how water is drained through that peatland, help to restore its natural function so that it can store carbon, mitigate the impacts of heavy rainfall and flooding downstream, and at the hotter, dry weather that you mentioned, mitigate the impacts of drought.
So forgive me, just to get this straight, then you rehydrate the peat to start with, and then you reshape it so that it holds onto the water better, and you replant within and around to assist that water retention. Is that right?
Exactly, and it's indicative of the wider sort of catchment restoration that the Trust is doing nationally. So it's a way of reconnecting that water with the landscape, and yeah. and in the uplands, that's generally sort of peatland restoration or ditch blocking. Sort of further down the catchment, as has been done at Holcombe as well, you can use a combination of sort of leaky dams. We've undertaken floodplain reconnection schemes across the country, and it's about getting that lateral connectivity of the water, creating these sponge landscapes that retain water, and in that develop resilience to extreme weather, but it also hugely benefits wildlife as well.
And how much work is involved in creating these thousands of what's called scallop bunds, these peat embankments? I mean, is it very labour intensive?
It is, but you use diggers. You can, but as well as sort of diggers, there is, and the National Trust have done this nationally as well, sort of low tech ways of doing it with teams of sort of volunteers. You can sort of play at being beaver with sort of putting sort of leaky dams and hinging trees and the like. So there's a range of different interventions, but in this case as well, it's linked to wider work with stakeholders. So working with the commoners that graze that land, you know, adapting that grazing to help develop a habitat that's conducive to peatland formation, and again, sort of developing that resilience, holding that water in the landscape.
Ben, thank you so much for sharing it with us. Ben Eardley there, National Trust Nature Recovery Project Manager.
13 minutes to 8 coming up in a few minutes. Johnny's going to be speaking to Sir James Cleverly, who has quit the Shadow Cabinet to run for London Mayor. Before that, it's always a pleasure when the Reverend Dr. Giles Fraser, Vicar of St. Anne's Church in Kew, comes in to give us thought for the day.
Hi, Amal. Generally speaking, I'm way more nervous of other people's virtues than their vices. Most people's vices are fairly humdrum: lust, gluttony, greed, sloth. Okay, people can do bad things chasing these, but if you want real nasty, start with their virtues, because it's often in the name of what people see as right and good that they do the most dreadful things. A small example of this caught my eye in the papers and on this programme over the last few days. Under Sevens football axed over violence, read the headline. Apparently, 750 children did not take part in football matches over the last weekend, the matches having been cancelled by the Scottish FA, because parents have been beating each other up on the touchline as they support their kids. Love of one's children is obviously a really good thing, but what is in itself a virtue can become something pretty horrible when it's used as a pretext for punching another parent in the face because their child has tackled yours. As I say, it's a small example. Another example is constantly there in the sort of rubbishy action movies that I love to distract myself with. Almost invariably, they start with something horrible having happened to the hero, in the name of which he, mostly he, justifies some bloody rampage against the baddies, and indeed justifies our enjoyment of it. If you let my daughter go, that'll be the end of it. But if you don't, I will look for you, I will find you, and I will kill you, to quote Liam Neeson. And he does. But by the end of all this epic carnage, perhaps we ought to wonder whether the genial-looking Neeson hasn't become one of the baddies himself. History demonstrates that cruelty is often justified in the name of justice. Hidden within our virtues, our love of family or country, for instance, terrible things can lurk unsuspected. Our virtues can be dangerous breeding grounds for vice because we don't generally question our virtues. People sometimes criticise churchgoers as self-righteous and morally superior, and that indeed can be present in all of us. But the reason we have a confession of sins in our services is precisely to warn that even in the most outwardly moral people, we have hidden resources of nastiness, often nestling in the places we least expected. Lots of people have pointed this out, from Jung to Nietzsche to Adam Smith, who warned that virtue is to be more feared than vice. But my favourite quote is from that great moral philosopher, Elizabeth Taylor. People with no vices, she said, usually have some pretty annoying virtues.
That was Thought for the Day with the Reverend Dr. Giles Fraser, Vicar of St. Anne's Church in Kew. It's 10 to 8.
1 minute you're in the Shadow Cabinet, the next you are pitching to be the Conservative candidate for London Mayor. Sir James Cleverly, former Home Secretary, former Foreign Secretary, wants to lead Europe's biggest city and has resigned from the Shadow Cabinet to try for the job. He has yet to be selected as the Conservative candidate, but joins us now. Good morning, Sir James.
Good morning.
The Conservative record in the last three mayoral elections is lose, lose, lose. What makes you think you can turn that around?
Well, I think there's a number of reasons. Firstly, I have a lot of experience both in national politics, but also in London politics. I cut my teeth in London politics. I was first elected to City Hall. And what we've also seen is that the Conservatives tend to do best in London when there is a Labour government. And what we've now seen is, particularly under Andy Burnham, an all-out assault on London. And we've seen the Prime Minister do things and his government do things which really indicate that he sees London as the problem rather than as a solution. And London needs a champion that's got experience, and yeah, I want to be that person.
You've spoken about this war on Londoners, and you've pointed to the reallocation of central government money away from London boroughs. I mean, Wandsworth in particular is looking at a big hike in council tax. A Band D council taxpayer in London pays just over £1,000. In Hartlepool, not a beacon of prosperity, it's £2,100. London is hardly being starved of money, is it?
Well, I don't think your examples really explain that criticism. I mean, if a local council has run their services efficiently, if they've been a careful custodian of public money, they are able to keep their council tax down. And London generates a huge amount of money, almost all of which is taken from those councils into the Treasury. And what we're seeing, and that's a classic example, what we're seeing is well-run, financially responsible London local government being punished, and the people who voted Conservative at the last elections clearly being punished. And the whole country, Hartlepool does well when London does well. Braintree does well when London does well. And the decisions that the government has made about things like public sector funding, local council funding, property taxation, business taxation, all these things accumulate to hold London back. And when London is held back, the whole country suffers.
You have also talked of a war on motorists. There's an awful lot of war around. And a vindictive assault on drivers. I mean, a fair number of people in London, visitors to London, will look at the traffic-choked streets and the high levels of pollution and wonder what you're on about.
Well, hang on, when you say high levels of pollution,
yeah,
I mean, that's an easy throwaway line, but actually air quality in London has been improving, and indeed was improving very significantly before these very restrictive policies were brought in by Sadiq Khan. And the simple fact of the matter is, in much of London, and it's very easy, and I think sadly Labour does this, caricatures London by looking, for example, at small parts of central London which are, you know, pretty well served by a public transport network, and assume that that's the whole of London. But in many parts of London, particularly the suburbs, particularly the outer edges of London, people's cars are not some luxury. It is how they live their lives. It's how they get from one place to another. And when the cost of running a car, particularly for those on low pay, gets ramped up and up and up, they really suffer. If you're wealthy, these additional costs are an inconvenience. If you're not wealthy, they are real problem.
You've been very critical. You've been very critical of the scheme to stop older, more polluting cars to come into the capital. There has been research which, with caveats, has suggested it's been something of a success in cutting pollution and improving the lives of Londoners. What do you make of that?
Oh, hang on a second. You're saying there has been research?
Yeah, there has. Recent research.
From where?
Forgive me if I don't have the details right at my fingertips,
well,
but
this is the point you're making. I recognise the point that it seems in the minds of some people axiomatic that if we make it really expensive for people, low paid workers, and out of London to drive, that must be a good thing. You're citing research without detailed provenance.
It's from Imperial College, figures. Sir James. It's from Imperial College. It was fairly well publicised a couple of weeks ago.
So the point I'm making is that it is there has been a very significant improvement. It was there when I was at City Hall, a very significant improvement in air quality. The air quality challenges for London have traditionally been clustered in central London. The figures for that have improved massively and were improving significantly before these processes, before these policies were brought in place. But the broader point I make is, in many parts of London where people are really struggling and the financial difficulties for them have got worse, it seems wrong to keep ramping up the costs on those people. And if we keep doing the same thing, if we don't look at these accumulated costs, the accumulated challenges, we shouldn't be surprised when people are being priced out of the city, when businesses
are being... Are you sure you're not standing for this because the Conservatives are looking at current projections like they're not going to get into power next time, and you yourself are threatened in your Braintree constituency?
What I am doing this for, and I've been thinking about this for some time, I came to my decision over the summer, I'm doing this because the Mayor of London, the current Mayor of London, has clearly lost his passion for the job. That's been clear since the last election. We have a Westminster government who has, at best, a very blasé attitude to London's place in the UK economy, and is doing a whole load of things, which is holding London back and damaging the UK as a whole. I want to change that. I want to be a passionate, forward-thinking, energetic champion for London to really unlock the city's full potential.
Sir James, we will leave it there. Thank you very much for joining us. Sir James Cleverly there.
3 minutes to eight, and throughout this week, Radio 4 looks for answers surrounding the events of 9/11.
On BBC Radio 4.
Two hijacked passenger aircraft were deliberately crashed into the twin towers of the World Trade Center.
25 years since the deadliest terror attack the world has seen. Why are grieving families still fighting for answers?
Saudi Arabia was considered an ally of the United States.
When the trail led to the consulate, it was disturbing.
And how might a man suspected of aiding the hijackers shed light on government secrets?
He said your government is lying when they tell you there was no state sponsors of this attack.
A 9/11 story with me, Jane McMullen, on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds. This Monday to Friday at 1:45.
2 minutes to eight. Let's get the weather with Helen Willetts. Hi, Helen.
Hi, Johnny. Thanks very much. Good morning. It's low pressure again today for the bank holiday for many of us, which means further scattered showers, but not everywhere will catch them. I think there'll be fewer further between compared with recent days, and not so many thunderstorms. It's not to say there won't be any. For England and Wales, the showers right now across the western side of Cumbria heading into Lancashire. They're across Wales into the West Country, and they're all tracking their way eastwards as the day goes on, giving way to drier, brighter weather actually in the west later as a ridge of high pressure starts to build a little bit more sunshine around. But we could see a few rumbles of thunder further east. Temperatures 18 on the west coast, 23, 24 in the south and the east, where it's still actually going to be a fairly breezy day, not quite as windy as yesterday and overnight. Northern Ireland, sunny spells and scattered showers this morning, giving way to slightly drier weather into the afternoon. 16 to 18 are highs here, but there's rain on the way this evening and overnight. Showers currently across mostly western Scotland, one or two in the east, but they will primarily become confined to eastern areas. The odd thunderstorm this afternoon, a little bit drier further west, 16 to 20.
Helen, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Johnny Diamond and Amol Rajan.
It's 8 o'clock on Monday, the 31st of August. The headlines this morning: Andy Burnham is facing more questions about the plan to release prisoners early to free up space. The Conservatives say dangerous offenders will be let out. The Victims Minister joins us after the news. The US and Iran have exchanged strikes in the first major military action for a month. And the rabbi at the Manchester synagogue, where two people were killed nearly a year ago, says the Jewish community there feels less safe now than in the days after the attack.
Also coming up in the next hour, will the AI bubble burst and what does it mean for you? The Bank of England governor is sounding the alarm bell. And this Saturday night, TV staple could be about to return to our screens. But will The X Factor have, well, The X Factor in today's media landscape? The BBC News is read by Alan Smith.
The Conservatives have warned that the government's planned changes to the early release scheme in England and Wales will still allow dangerous prisoners to be freed. The Prime Minister yesterday excluded those convicted of unlawful killing, but said he would allow the release of some inmates being held under a policy known as imprisonment for public protection. The Shadow Justice Secretary, Nick Timothy, says ministers must now allow their plans to be properly scrutinised, as our political correspondent Jack Fenwick reports.
Andy Burnham said yesterday that hundreds of prisoners previously eligible for early release would now be kept behind bars. One way he hopes to free up capacity on the prison estate is by releasing people on IPP sentences. Many have been let out at some point and then recalled to prison, but more than 800 have never been freed because of decisions taken by the parole board. Nick Timothy told the BBC the Prime Minister was stopping the release of some criminals by deciding to release others. He said the people who are still in prison on IPP sentences are dangerous, and expert assessors have concluded they are not safe to release. Mr. Timothy conceded that the previous Conservative government had failed to build enough prison spaces. The government is set to announce more details on its plans for early release in Parliament tomorrow.
Shirley de Bono, who's campaigned against IPPs since her son was given one in 2006, told us the government must provide a clear timeframe for when prisoners might be released. But the former Conservative Justice Secretary Sir Robert Buckland said the government had inherited a scheme which had been drawn up without thinking about the wider consequences.
The numbers are now reduced, and I welcome that, but there will still be anomalies. And I'm sure once we hear the announcement from the government tomorrow, there will be other families saying, well, hold on, why is this class of prisoner not being released, and yet other serious offenders are coming out of prison?
The US military says it struck two Iranian missile launches on an island in the Strait of Hormuz in the first known military action in a month. American officials say Iranian forces were preparing to fire rockets carrying sea mines into the waterway. Iran says it's retaliated by targeting US military personnel in the United Arab Emirates and in Jordan. The price of Brent crude oil has already jumped 2%. Our Middle East correspondent Yolande Nell reports from Jerusalem.
The US said it carried out a limited, precise action to protect trade and shipping after Iranian forces were observed getting ready to launch rockets with sea mines into the Strait of Hormuz. The US military had said it completed demining the waterway last week. Iranian media reported sounds of explosions near Larak Island, and Iran's Revolutionary Guard said several of its fighters and civilians were killed and injured. The guards vowed a response and punishment. Overnight, Jordan's armed forces said 8 Iranian missiles were intercepted in its airspace. The latest exchange of fire comes just days after the Trump administration said that it was shifting to tight economic sanctions rather than military options to try to end its war with Iran.
The United Nations has warned it's still extremely difficult to access the parts of Nepal worst hit by last week's flash flooding. Officials say 900 people are now confirmed to have died. Rescuers are going through debris looking for the more than 4,000 people who are missing, including 900 trapped in tunnels that form part of hydroelectric power stations. Our South Asia correspondent Azadeh Mashiri reports from the town of Dunche.
Rescue efforts continue with helicopters passing over us every few minutes. Those across northern Nepal that have survived the flood are now picking up the pieces. Here in Dunche, residents are living with pockets of electricity and relying on generators. Nearby villages were swallowed by floodwater, leaving many people displaced and living in camps. One man told us anyone you speak to here will know dozens of people who have died. Meanwhile, a team of 90 rescuers have been pumping air into the Trishuli 3A hydro tunnel, hoping to save the workers trapped inside. The crew has blasted a hole in the crown of the tunnel, and rescuers have descended on ropes. But the Prime Minister has said so far they've received no response. India and China, which have experience with tunnel rescues, have sent their own experts to help.
Over the border in Tibet, Chinese state media says rescue efforts are continuing, but the hopes of finding survivors are fading, as our China correspondent Stephen McDonnell reports from Beijing.
On the Tibetan side of the border, it's now more than 6 days since the devastating flash floods hit, and no survivors have been found since last week. Yet, even with slim hopes of success, emergency teams are reportedly still combing the worst-hit area around the destroyed border processing centre. Chinese police say they've also begun targeting people whose social media posts are deemed to be exaggerating the seriousness of the emergency, with punishments including fines and possible detention. Most of those listed as having been caught have spoken about a much higher death toll. However, with 546 people declared as missing, the real death toll in Tibet is almost certainly far greater than the current official figure.
Search and rescue teams have been working through the night in northern Cyprus to find more than a dozen missing people after a passenger ferry capsized and sank off the coast. At least eight people have died. The catamaran was carrying around 270 people, most of whom have been rescued. The rabbi of Heaton Park Synagogue in Manchester, where two men were killed last October, has told the BBC the Jewish community there feels less safe now than it did immediately after the attack. Daniel Walker blamed rising anti-Semitism. A memorial service will be held at the synagogue this evening for the victims and survivors of the attack. Our special correspondent Judith Moritz reports.
Rabbi Daniel Walker said rising anti-Semitism, combined with what he described as a lack of action to deal with core problems, had left many of his congregants and British Jews more widely feeling increasingly vulnerable.
Looking back, I think we're actually almost in a harder position than we were even immediately after the attack. I think the sense of vulnerability has grown, it hasn't diminished.
Two men, Melvin Kravitz and Adrian Dolby, were killed and three others injured as they tried to defend their synagogue from an attacker on the holiest day of the Jewish year, Yom Kippur. A wave of worldwide anti-Semitic attacks followed over subsequent months. Today's commemoration will take place under tight security. A BBC Freedom of Information request to police forces in England and Wales has found that across 33 forces, violent hate crimes targeting Jewish people, such as harassment and assault, have risen by nearly two-thirds since 2022.
The Conservative MP Dame Priti Patel has announced that she's leaving her role as the Shadow Foreign Secretary. In a post on social media, she said she was taking up an international role for the party. Dame Priti's departure is expected to be part of a wider reshuffle, and the BBC understands she's set to be replaced by Tom Tugendhat. Conservationists say an innovative scheme to rapidly re-wet part of upland moors has helped to protect against both wildfires and flooding. The National Trust has been working with tenant farmers and bodies including the Environment Agency and the Ministry of Defence to restore hundreds of acres in Greater Manchester. Rebecca Drought reports.
On the top of the moor in Holcombe near Manchester, the ground stayed wet this summer despite the heat waves. The National Trust believes this was thanks to a scheme to build more than 3,000 scallop funds, semicircular peat embankments covered in vegetation that capture rainwater. These have created pools and boggy ground which have helped support wildlife and allowed sphagnum moss, which holds huge amounts of water, to be restored. Gullies through the peat have also been dammed to slow water pouring off the hillside and prevent flooding. Experts say bunds could be used elsewhere to provide natural flood management and make the land more resilient to fire.
And there could be some good news for anyone who's enjoyed a lie-in over the bank holiday weekend. New research suggests a modest amount of extra sleep at the weekend could be linked to a lower risk of high blood pressure, particularly among people who are physically inactive. Lucy Atchison reports.
Researchers at Korea University in Seoul analysed data from almost 41,000 adults, looking at how much extra sleep they got at weekends. They found that weekend catch-up sleep was associated with 6% lower odds of high blood pressure. Among people who were physically inactive, the odds were around 7% lower, with the best improvement seen in those getting around 1 to 2 hours of extra sleep. However, there was a catch. Getting too much extra sleep was associated with a higher prevalence of high blood pressure. The researchers say other measures, including eating well and staying active, remain important for reducing the risk of hypertension. But perhaps you don't need to feel quite so guilty about hitting the snooze button on your weekend alarm.
That report was from Lucy Atchison.
Alan, thank you very much indeed. It's 8:10. What to do about Britain's broken prison system? Nobody could doubt that the word crisis is apposite for the situation in British jails, or that this was one of the stickiest and toughest parts of Labour's inheritance from the Tories' time in power. The question is whether the planned solutions of the Labour government to the problem could end up worsening the problem. It takes a lot of time and money to build a prison. There are almost 87,000 prisoners across England and Wales, and only 2,000 spaces remaining. You need to run the system with some leeway, some spaces free or capacity, because you need somewhere for violent criminals to go. And because it takes so long to build a prison, the answer recently has been that you've got to release some who are already there. But who and how many? Trade-offs abound here, and the government may have to choose between bad options and worse ones. A couple of statistics for you. As of March, more than 70,000 people had been released under a scheme launched in 2024, an early release scheme. To be clear, that is 70,000 people who should be doing porridge, but instead are among civilians. The Prime Minister has said those convicted of unlawful killing will not be allowed out, but some inmates held under IPP sentences, that's imprisonment for public protection, will. Well, what about protecting the public? Earlier, we spoke to the former Conservative Justice Secretary, Sir Robert Buckland, who said he had concerns about the proposal as some of these prisoners on IPP sentences, are violent offenders.
Just under 1,000 people remain in prison on IPPs, having never been released. And the majority of them are in for very serious offences. Mm. You know, they're not in for stealing a loaf of bread. They're in for serious violent and sexual offences. And therefore, there is a public protection element that remains. However, that number is dwarfed now by the people who've been recalled. The recall figures, I think, are about 12 or 1,300, which is more than the number of people who've never been released. And it seems to me, looking at those recalls, looking at the circumstances, working out what packages can be given to support people back into the community is the way that we're going to crack this particular nut.
So that was Sir Robert Buckland, former Conservative Justice Secretary. Let's speak now to Alex Davies-Jones, Minister for Victims, Violence Against Women and Girls and International Justice. Good morning.
Good morning.
Let's start with the principle before we get into some of the detail. How can a government whose primary duty is the safety of the people let hundreds of potentially violent criminals onto the streets?
The government's number one priority is to keep the public safe. And in order to do that, we need a functioning criminal justice system. If we don't have capacity in our prisons, that means the police are unable to arrest anyone, our courts are unable to sentence anyone, and the criminal justice system will just seek to function. When you have a prison capacity crisis, you either close the front door or you open the back door. What we're doing is ensuring we have sustainability, we are doing this safely and responsibly to ensure that there is always a prison place available for someone who needs it.
Andy Burnham said on the 4th of August, "I have pushed to the very limits of what is possible to do. I know I can look people in the eye and say to them, there is nothing more I could have asked for without risking the prison system reaching capacity and collapsing within months." But his position has changed since then, hasn't it?
He has. He's pushed. He's pushed and pushed and wouldn't accept no for an answer.
But hasn't he pushed in a way that makes the public less safe, potentially? I'm not suggesting any... No one's suggesting any of this is easy. As I say, there's lots of trade-offs. It's all bad options. But isn't the way in which he's pushed ending up in a place where you potentially have violent offenders on the streets?
No, we needed to ensure that there was capacity within our prison system whilst also listening to victims like Lissy Harper, the widow of PC Andrew Harper, like many others who have spoken out about their concerns regarding exemptions to the progression model. It is important that their views were taken into consideration. But we do know that individuals will be coming out of prison, and it's important that they are managed effectively in the community, because release does not mean freedom. There is a presumption that everyone who is released from prison will be put on a GPS tag. We're introducing for the first time ever a world first restriction zones so that offenders are placed into a controlled area and their movements limited, their liberty curtailed. We're also ensuring that victims can feed into licensing conditions for their offender. Again, something that hasn't been done under previous early release schemes because it was done under cloak and dagger, under secrecy with no transparency. So we're ensuring we're doing this responsibly and effectively and safely to ensure that all views are taken into consideration.
A lot of your voters, Mr. Davies-Jones, might say that that's all well and good, but people who are sentenced to prison should be in prison. David Gawke, the former Tory Justice Secretary, said, and I quote, "The reality is that the remaining IPPs, as in the people who are on these imprisonment for public protection sentences, he says they're in prison for good reason. They have been assessed, brackets, repeatedly as being high risk. For example, he says, I looked at their prison disciplinary records and in many cases it was clear why they'd not been released. Given all that, how can you say, despite the fact you've got these measures in place to make sure that it's not complete liberty when they come outside, shouldn't they be inside?"
So you mentioned IPP prisoners. These are incredibly complex cases, as you heard the former Conservative Lord Justice Secretary state there. You know, this isn't black and white. They are very individual and they need to be looked at carefully. But they are also historic injustices. Over 80% of individuals who are on IPPs have served decades over and above their original sentence. So it's important that these cases are looked at in order to free up capacity within the system. But public protection remains paramount. We will need legislation to do this, to look at this holistically. And I'm really pleased that actually you've seen, you know, Lord Moylan, the Conservative shadow minister, welcoming the announcement that we will be looking at this. Then that cross-party consensus is really important if we're to tackle this problem properly, because these sentences were abolished in 2012. They don't exist anymore. They can't be forward-looking, but they weren't replied retrospectively. So it's important that we do that work. We look at the individual cases and we take the time to get it right. And we will do that.
And yet it was one of your colleagues, the Labour Justice Minister Jake Richards, who said in January abolishing the IPP sentences retrospectively would result in prisoners being released whom the Independent Parole Board has determined are too dangerous. This would pose an unacceptable risk of harm to victims and the public. That was your justice colleague.
He also said in that same statement that these are very complex cases and they need to be looked at carefully. And that is what we will do. We will do nothing that would risk the public or put the public at danger. But we do need to address the historic injustice of IPP sentences. We need to look at every case on its merits individually and pass the appropriate legislation. And we will do that responsibly and we will take our time to get it right.
You mentioned the capacity. Let's get into the detail then. How many places do you forecast that the freeing up that you've got planned will actually create?
So it's really important to recognise here that under the original Sentencing Act, when we passed it, we were anticipating an initial 6,000 prisoners to be released earlier than planned over 10-month tranches. So not on day one, but that was the initial cohort. When the Prime Minister came into office, he created exemptions preventing anyone convicted of rape or serious child sex offences from being released. That reduced those coming out early initially to around 5,000. Following the announcement yesterday that from the Prime Minister and the Lord Chancellor that anyone sentenced to unlawful killing, so that includes manslaughter, death by dangerous driving and some historic sex offences as well included in those exemptions, we will now see around an initial 4,500 prisoners coming out over those 10 months, over 10 tranches, so they can be safely and effectively monitored by probation in the community earlier than planned. So that is the aim. And just so your listeners have an idea of what happens on an average month, business as usual for our prison estate is around 4,500 individuals being released because they have reached that point in their sentence where their sentence is finished and then they are released and effectively managed in the community.
Is that actually going to create the capacity you need to keep the justice system running though?
It is going to run it very tight. We will have capacity within the system with those numbers, but it will be run very tight, which is why the Prime Minister has tasked us and the Lord Chancellor with looking at what more we can do regarding IPP prisoners by deporting foreign national offenders who are within the criminal justice system quicker, more faster. What can we do to free up capacity within the female estate and repurpose some of that? Because as we know, the problem we have, the capacity crisis we have, is in the male estate, where we're currently running at 98% capacity. So that is where our challenges lie. And that is what we need to, that's why we need to solve some of these problems and look at more creative solutions in order to do so.
You mentioned foreign nationals. So I just want to give the listeners the numbers. There are 10,134 foreign nationals in custody as of late June. That represents 12% of the overall population. You are removing hundreds of them.
Yeah.
To be very clear, are those people that you are removing, the hundreds out of that 10,134, are they being removed to custody in other countries, i.e. they're going to serve their sentence abroad, or are they going to be sentenced in Britain, then flown home and released overseas?
So these individuals are being sent back to their country of origin, their biometric data taken, and they will never have the right to return back to the UK.
Are they going to be in prison or in jail serving sentences overseas?
That would be for the determination of their country of origin. What we do know is that currently, as you said, 10,000 foreign national offenders taking up space within our criminal justice system, the vast majority of them on remand awaiting court dates. Our plan is to deport them on sentencing so that they don't serve a day at His Majesty's pleasure and at the taxpayer's pleasure, the UK taxpayer, in our prisons, because we need our prison places for British offenders. Why is the British taxpayer paying to lock up foreign national offenders when they should be sent back to their country of origin?
Hang on, so the ambition for the 10,134 foreign nationals currently in our jails, so that was as of late June, it would have moved around a bit. The ambition is after they've served, at what point exactly are you planning to deport them?
On sentencing, immediately.
And all 100% of them?
That's the aim. We need to work on prisoner transfer agreements with other countries, our international partners, of course. This is more complex. It's not as black and white.
You're talking about lots of different countries, of course. It's incredibly difficult. And some of those countries are unstable, of course. And, you know, it's not very easy, that's the aim. Yeah. Okay, why wouldn't you expedite that? Because that's a bigger number. 10,134. If you could get that number down much quicker, then you're going to create much more capacity rather than, as you say, running it as tight as you are.
It's a very good question. And as I said, the vast majority of that 10,000 number are actually on remand, which means that they haven't actually been sentenced yet. They haven't even had their trial yet. We don't even know if they've been found guilty or innocent yet. The criminal justice system is a system and every part of it needs to work. When we came into office 2 years ago, every part of it was broken. Our courts were in a huge backlog. Our prisons were in crisis and a capacity. Victim support services and probation on their knees. We came in as a Labour government and we've tried to pick it all back up and rebuild it. But it is going to take time. Chronic years of underfunding, a failure to build any prison places, a failure to tackle the court backlog, whilst closing prisons. The Conservatives closed 23 prisons and built just 500 net places, and whilst increasing sentences for offences without ensuring we had prison spaces available.
Absolutely acknowledged in the introduction that it's a very, very difficult part of your inheritance, and also that there are lots and lots of trade-offs. But I just want to put to you one thought, which is that you are, you know, the minister responsible for this. You will have discussed, won't you, in Number 10 and in government, the possibility that some of the people that you release will do terrible, terrible things, and that will be on you.
What I will not stand for and what this government must be responsible for is to keep the public safe and ensure that there is always a prison place available for someone who needs it. The worst thing in the world would be for a domestic abuser to be sentenced to prison and we are not able to lock them up because there isn't a prison place available, so we have to send them home back to their victim. That is unconscionable. That would be untenable, and that is something that this government is not prepared to do.
Alex Davies-Jones, Minister for Victims, Violence Against Women and Girls and International Justice. Thank you.
It's 22 minutes past eight and finance ministers from the world's 20 biggest economies are gathering today in Asheville in North Carolina, and they'll be greeted by a pretty gloomy warning from the Governor of Bank of England, Andrew Bailey. He's written to them with a warning about the extraordinary levels of debt piling up to fuel spending on artificial intelligence, warning about markets being vulnerable to potentially disorderly correction, he says, a correction that may be amplified by that towering debt. So the bubble burst could be very nasty and could, he says, spread across borders in the letter that was first reported in The Telegraph. Mohamed El Erian is professor at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania, chief economic advisor to Allianz Insurers. I asked him why he believes the governor sent this letter.
The history of financial markets has been that they fall in love with something and they enable it and then they tend to overdo it. And financial markets have fallen in love, rightly, with the promise of artificial intelligence, the extent to which it can improve productivity and improve earnings. They've supplied a tremendous amount of financing, both directly and what's called circular financing. When I lend to you, you lend to me, and we both keep the game going. And there is a worry that this may go too far. And it's ironic because the power of the capital markets is to finance innovations, but if it goes too far, then it can undermine economic growth.
And that circular financing, where you have big tech lending money to AI companies, lending money to big tech, et cetera, these companies that essentially sort of funding each other's vast projects, is why presumably the governor uses that word amplifying, the risk of amplifying a market correction because of this sort of dependency that's built up?
Yes, and the amplification comes from several ways. One, it comes from the structure of the finance, as you just mentioned. Yes. Secondly, AI has driven market-wide gains. And then thirdly, AI has been driving economic growth. It's the one of the two very important engines of U.S. economic growth, and U.S. economic growth is the engine for global growth. So I suspect the governor is seeing this amplification happen within finance, across finance, and then from finance to the economy.
He writes of a disorderly correction that could spread across borders. I mean, he is suggesting, presumably, that Europe and the UK are not immune, even if they have not seen these extraordinary explosions in valuations that the US has.
Yes, I suspect he's very influenced by the 2008 global financial crisis. Mm-hmm. There, it was something called securitization. That was the innovation. It went too far. It was mainly in the US. But when things go wrong in finance, what happens in the US does not stay in the US. The US tends to export both positive and negative financial shocks around the world.
Do you share the governor's concern?
Look, everything about AI has this enormous promise, and then there's a side that is less good, the peril, if you like. So it's the promise and the peril. The extreme of that is the arguments between abundance and extinctions. When you come back in to something, I think, that's not extreme, you have these very delicate balances that have to be struck. On the one hand, an incredible innovation that's going to allow us not just to do things better, but to invent new ways of doing things. It can solve a lot of our problem. On the other hand, it comes with a lot of risks that need to be mitigated. So it's a question of unleashing the benefits and managing the risks.
Do you believe that the people pouring money into these stocks understand what you call a very delicate balance?
I think they do, but you have to understand the mindset here, Johnny. It's a venture capitalist mindset. There's a notion that not everybody is going to be a winner here. There's a winner-take-all dynamic to it. So if you're an investor, you spread your bets across, knowing that certain bets will lose, but the ones that win will win really big. Mm. It's what I call a rational bubble. Is it a bubble? Yes, there's way too much money being directed now to anything that has AI on it. Is it rational? It is rational because there's a notion that if you get one of your five or six bets right, you will do extremely well. So we are living in this world of a rational bubble.
Bubbles do burst, don't they? And someone gets hurt.
They do. They can burst in a small way or in a big way. Yeah. And that is what the governor is worried about. He's worried that if we don't manage this process better, then if and when the bubble bursts, it can have economic consequences that we don't need right now.
Mohammed El-Aryan, thank you very much.
28 minutes past eight. Coming up in the next half an hour, comedian Mark Gatiss on reprising his role as the bookish detective and why the British love of crime dramas shows no signs of abating. And also at the end of the programme, we're going to be talking about the return of X Factor. Time now is 28 minutes past eight, and that means Jonathan is here with a sport.
Morning again. A night to forget in New York for Novak Djokovic, who said he, quote, despised every moment of his defeat to Argentina's Mario Navarro, which lasted nearly 5 hours and ended his US Open hopes on the opening day. He was frequently in tears in the match, his body convulsed in pain, not for the first time this season, as he suffered his first-round defeat in 20 years.
It's something that I've been carrying, unfortunately, pretty much every match this year. You know, vomiting, throwing up, serious issue there. And then my whole body, you know, starts to collapse, basically cramping and pain. And yeah, the back just gave up in the end.
Britain's Cam Norrie also went out, not quite as painfully, but British qualifier Toby Samuel and Katie Bolter both won. Arina Sabalenka and Carlos Alcaraz play later today. Now, another weekend winner was England's returning cricket captain, Joe Root. He and his team won the second test against Pakistan at Lord's by 194 runs, which meant they won the series with a match to play next week. Big contrast to the series defeat to New Zealand earlier in the summer, which included the resignation of Ben Stokes as captain. So what's going right now? Let's call up the chief cricket commentator, Jonathan Agnew. Morning.
Good morning, everybody.
So what has changed?
Well, they seem to be back on track, don't they? I mean, looking at the way that England played in the last two test matches, and it is early days, and we are obviously looking for contrasts between the previous regime, if you like, and this one, but they're more knuckled down. That's the evidence. I mean, here they were put into bat at Lord's on a really awkward conditions. I mean, very humid, damp, a very green pitch. Then knuckled down and got 290. And you wonder what might have happened. I'm not saying it wouldn't have happened before, but just the manner in which they played, both here and at Headingley, the batsmen in particular, was going about some hard work. You know, not just shrugging shoulders and saying, oh right, okay, we're going to, you know, get on, launch the attack. That can work sometimes, but often doesn't. And on these two occasions, knuckling down, hard work, bit of graft, discipline, all the things that we've been talking about over the last couple of years did work.
Is that Joe Root 2.0 as captain coming back?
Well, a lot of it is, definitely, because that's the way that he plays. And in those days of Bazball, if you want to call it that, there were times at the start particularly where he seemed to be quite confused about it. He wasn't quite sure about his own game, I don't think, when everything changed to be such an aggressive form of cricket. He got used to it, he accommodated it. I mean, he's a terrific player. But he certainly seems more authoritative on the field. He took control 2 days before the game of the latest off-field drama, of course, which is normally, I think, would be a management role, but Joe Root stood up and did that, and he read the Riot Act to the players. I did ask him at the end of the interview last night, a quiet night tonight, Joe.
reports yet, by the way.
No, thank goodness. He had a little chuckle and walked off. He knows what we meant, you know, and all of that has to stop. And I think that, you know, Joe Root, you know, for whatever reason he's ended up being captain again, is absolutely the right man to lead England at the moment.
Okay, England bowling attack question coming from Amol Rajan.
Morning, Aggers. It's Amol here. I couldn't help myself. Sorry. There's a brilliant piece this morning, Aggers, in the Times from Simon Wild, where he says, in Australia, during the Ashes, what matters isn't pace, but movement off the pitch. And there's other people, I think you possibly, Aggers, as a former bowler, who think that actually the big thing for Ollie Robinson is, can he add 3 or 4, maybe 5 miles an hour to his bowling, even at the age of 32, which would mean that with that Kookaburra ball on flat wickets in Australia, he is actually still a threat. And if he is going to do that, should he do what the great Harold Rhodes did in the 1950s, where he was sent to the Duke of Devonshire's estate at Chatsworth and chop wood over the winter?
Well, they think I would help. I don't think Ollie would like that very much. But no, look, being serious, I think there's two parts to what you're saying. Can he add 5 miles an hour to where he starts? No, because that would take him up to 88 miles an hour, and that's, you know, seriously fast bowling. Can he maintain 82, 83 miles an hour for longer? That's the question. That's what England are going to try and do, because he starts off at that sort of speed very effectively, but it does slip down to 77, 78. That's what they want to try and stop. They want to try and keep him bowling at that 82 for longer. He's absolutely outstanding. I mean, his accuracy, the field placing, all this question of the wicketkeeper standing up now has added a whole new dimension to this, because the batsmen can't get out of the crease. They can't get down to it. They've got to stay where they are. They're deeper in the crease. DRS comes in, all the technology, so the ball's unlikely to go over the stumps. All of these things, and the fact that actually the conditions have been very helpful, have helped him. But my word, he is, and I said it at the start when he first started playing, one of the most natural bowlers that I've ever seen, and he's just getting better and better.
Thank you very much, Need. On that positive note, Jonathan Agnew, thank you very much indeed. You're in your place now. You understand all about it. Amol Rajan, thank you very much indeed.
Two sports presenters for the price of one there. Thank you, Jonathan. Thank you, Amol. As part of Radio 4's Norman Day, Greg Jenner brings his light-hearted lens to the tumultuous events of 1066.
Norman Day on BBC Radio 4.
1066, perhaps the most famous year in all of English history. And in a special edition of You're Dead to Me, we're exploring what led to the seismic Battle of Hastings.
Harold ends up in Normandy.
We don't know why. He's trying some croissants.
The story has it all. Multiple battles, an alleged illicit affair, and a lot of horses.
If you've got, say, 3,000 horses, how much poo do you think they would produce?
Join me, Greg Jenner, and my guests for You're Dead to Me, part of Norman Day on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds, this Thursday afternoon at 4.
The Today programme, of course, will be taking part in the fun. Nick will be at the British Museum with the Bayeux Tapestry on Thursday.
Time now is 26 minutes to 9. You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Johnny Diamond and Amol Rajan. Here's a summary of the news from Alan Smith.
The Conservatives say the government's planned changes to the early release scheme in England and Wales could still put the public at risk, with dangerous offenders being freed. The Prime Minister wants to make some inmates serving imprisonment for public protection sentences eligible for release. The Minister for Victims, Alex Davis-Jones, told this programme that IPP cases were not black and white. She said there was a historic injustice in their use, and that 80% of those still serving them had spent decades in jail over and above their original sentences. The US military says it struck two Iranian missile launchers in the Strait of Hormuz to try to stop mines being put in the waterway. Tehran has attacked US air bases in Jordan in response. Rescuers in Nepal are trying to reach hundreds of workers trapped underground at a hydropower plant following last week's devastating floods. More than 900 people have died in Nepal and more than 4,000 are missing. And search and rescue teams have been working through the night in northern Cyprus to find more than a dozen missing people after a passenger ferry capsized and sank off the coast. At least 8 people have died.
Thanks very much, Alan. This evening in Manchester, there'll be a communal commemoration for those killed and injured at the Heaton Park synagogue attack on the Jewish holy day of Yom Kippur last year. Adrian Dalby and Melvin Kravitz were killed on October the 2nd as they tried to defend their synagogue from an attacker. The commemoration will be a solemn one. The chief rabbi will be there, as will the community secretary, Angela Rayner. But Heaton Park's synagogue rabbi, Daniel Walker, has sounded the alarm. He's been speaking to our special correspondent, Judith Moritz, who's on the line. Good morning, Judith. What did Rabbi Daniel Walker say to you?
Yeah, he was speaking to me in advance of the service, which will be held this evening. And, you know, we're approaching the first anniversary of the attack, but I should just explain that that in itself is a complicated thing, because it doesn't just affect one day. As you were outlining there, the attack itself happened on the 2nd of October last year. But as the Jewish calendar is a lunar one, and it happened on the holy day of Yom Kippur, this year Yom Kippur falls next month. And the congregation will have some private prayers to remember Adrian Dalby and Melvin Kravitz on that day. But Rabbi Walker told me he also felt, along with leaders of the community, that it's important to hold a public service, and that's what they're going to have this evening, before this run of Jewish holy days begins. And he told me that's because they want to ensure that those affected are remembered by wider society, and so that a call for change can be heard loud and clear, because this comes, of course, at a time of heightened anti-Semitism globally and in the UK. That attack at Heaton Park was followed by a mass shooting at a Hanukkah celebration in Australia and a spate of arson and knife attacks on Jewish people and property in London, and a BBC Freedom of Information request to police forces in England and Wales has found that across 33 forces, violent hate crimes targeting Jewish people have risen by nearly two-thirds since 2022. So Rabbi Walker, in that context, told me that a year of difficulty and of grief and of pain has been made even harder by those attacks elsewhere. He told me he feels something has gone seriously wrong in our society, and believes the anniversary will be a time when members of the Jewish community will be asking how it can be ensured that no more attacks happen. He doesn't think the community feels secure enough yet.
I think, looking back, I think we're actually almost in a harder position than we were even immediately after the attack. I think the sense of vulnerability has grown. It hasn't diminished. I think the increased security is extremely, we're extremely grateful for it, but I don't think there's really any evidence of anyone dealing with the core problems.
We've also heard from other members of the Heaton Park community. The synagogue security guard, Bernard Ashimang, is still recovering from the severe injuries he sustained when the attacker drove at him with his car. And he's told us at the BBC that he continues to struggle with the memories of the attack, which still feel as vivid to him as they did in the aftermath. The family of Melvin Kravitz have told us that tonight's commemoration will give them strength and support, and the act of remembering is of the utmost importance. And this is a service which we know will take place under tight security. It'll involve a police operation on a similar scale to those deployed for football matches and music events. And speakers tonight will include the chief rabbi, the chief constable of Greater Manchester, and one of those injured in the attack as well, Yoni Finlay.
Judith, thank you very much indeed. Judith Moritz, our special correspondent. Well, we can speak to Yonny Finlay now. Good morning.
Good morning.
Can we talk about the year gone by? I mean, a hard year, no doubt, when you have learnt much about your community, your city and the country, I guess.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point to say. It's certainly not been the easiest year. Certainly far stronger than I was last Yom Kippur. But I think the emotional side has been a lot harder to deal with. But I have been supported in so many ways. My kids have been amazing, my parents, my family, the rabbi, the whole community, really. And I'm particularly proud of my kids, who've been through probably one of the hardest things that a kid should ever have to experience. And they've been amazing. You know, their strength, their resilience, that helps me every day.
Can we just talk about what the rabbi has told Judith, that the community is in a harder position now than a year ago, that the sense of vulnerability has grown, there's no evidence of dealing with the core problems. I think a fair number of people will be surprised by that. Can you open up about that, elaborate a little bit?
Yeah, I don't think things feel safer. I think we certainly, we live behind, you know, ever-increasing gates, more security than we've ever had. And as the rabbi pointed out, it's great that we have that support. And I think more is being done. I think the Chief Constable of Greater Manchester has been great in making changes and supporting the community, and the government have done certain things. But, you know, any event that we attend, you know, within the community, the address is never displayed on the poster. You know, there are reports that come out, the anti-Semitic assaults are up. You know, there's the review on the NHS, you know, that Jewish staff don't feel safe, that there are Jewish people that don't want to attend appointments because they're worried. Universities are less safe. You know, Jewish people are having to hide their identity. Even my own son, who's in college at the moment, has faced death threats.
I mean, your synagogue was struck on Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. It's the holiest day in the Jewish year. It's coming round again. What are your feelings as Yom Kippur approaches?
It's not going to be easy. You know, in some respects, it's, you know, it's a year on, and maybe my initial thoughts at the time were that a year on, maybe things would feel easier. But I don't think they do. And I think that's, I attended the National Day for Survivors and Victims of Terrorism in London just over a week ago. And I think, to me, that memorial showed, and I think the memorial tonight will show that as well, is that we're not alone, but that the pain and the trauma that we've been through isn't forgotten because it doesn't go away. And I think it's also that it's okay not to be okay, and there's not really a timeline on it. There's no sort of linear path that trauma sort of goes on. But I think tonight will show, you know, somebody evil came to our synagogue last year and tried to destroy us, and we haven't let that happen. Tonight, there's not a spare seat, there's not a spare ticket to be had, and I believe that's testament to how much support that we do have, and that's across all facets of the community.
Yonny, thanks so much for coming on the programme today. We appreciate it, and I hope it goes well this evening.
Thank you.
Time now, 17 minutes to 9. A series of Russian attacks has hit publishing houses and printing presses across Ukraine, destroying around 12 million books and leaving some schools short of textbooks for the new term. Russia is accused of targeting other artistic and cultural sites in an attempt to damage symbols of Ukrainian heritage. Prior to the full-scale invasion 4.5 years ago, Vladimir Putin questioned the legitimacy of an independent Ukrainian state and culture. Our Ukraine correspondent, or our correspondent in Ukraine, Dan Johnson, reports from some of the places now feeling the impact of the war.
On the edge of Ukraine's capital, the Konvi publishing house bears the imprint of Russia's latest attacks. Its bombed-out remains, testament to a dark new chapter of this war. The printing press has been almost completely destroyed. It's burned, the roof has collapsed here. You can still smell the aftermath, and there are piles of charred books, and then some others that have sort of survived, but they've suffered water damage. These are actually English textbooks that should have been destined for schools. It says, "I'm William and I'm from the UK. My dad is Ukrainian, but my mum is British. My grandmother
lives in Nottingham. It's a beautiful city. This means there's going to be a textbook shortage now for the start of the new term.
The company's commercial director, Victoria Hyde, tells me the strike came just as they were ramping up to print 1.3 million textbooks.
I believe it is deliberate on the part of the Russian Federation. Over the past 2 months, some of the largest publishing houses have lost their warehouses, where very large quantities of books were stored. The Russians are also destroying printing houses in an attempt to erase Ukraine as a nation, but frankly, they will not succeed.
Kyiv's Pochina second-hand book market was also hit, burning down hundreds of stalls and destroying countless treasured books. In the smouldering ruins, I met Lilia Velika, a book blogger determined to salvage something from the ashes.
Books are saving us, and losing this is like losing our hearts.
It's not only books. Museums, art galleries, opera houses and a film studio have been damaged. Symbols of collective identity Ukrainians believe are being targeted to undermine their sense of national belonging. And a Russian drone hit the golden domes of Kyiv-Pechersk Lavra, a cultural and spiritual icon and a UNESCO World Heritage Site.
The decoration in here is incredibly ornate. There's gold leaf everywhere. It's seriously impressive with really detailed images and murals. There are fans running to try to dry this cathedral out because of the water damage, and I can still smell the impact of the fire that tore through the roof.
UNESCO Director General Khalid El Anani visited on the monastery's 975th anniversary.
I was deeply saddened to see today the significant damage caused by June attacks. UNESCO firmly condemns them and all attacks against cultural property protected under international law.
Russia denied targeting the Pechersk Lavra and claimed to only attack sites with military links. Ukraine's culture minister, Tatiana Berezhna, dismisses that.
This is existential war, so Russia wants to destroy us as a nation, to erase us as a nation like Ukrainians do not exist and have never existed. That's why Russia targets our cultural heritage, the symbols of our presence here for a lot of time. They understand that it's very important for us because we protect our identity, we protect our culture, and Russia wants to ruin everything that it cannot appropriate.
She says digitization can protect art and literature and ensure children can learn even without physical books. But back at Convy Publishing, Victoria Hyde captures the depth these attacks strike at.
In the beginning was the word. The word is everything. It is our development, our culture and our historical heritage that is passed down from generation to generation. The word is born in a book. And the book is born in a printing house.
Vladimir Putin has denied the existence of a distinct Ukrainian culture, but the sight of burning books means his war is only hardening determination here to ensure it survives.
Our Ukraine correspondent Dan Johnson reporting there. Over on Radio 3 now, Tom McKinney is introducing Johann Sebastian Bach's rather jaunty fourth Brandenburg concerto, complete with dazzling violin solos and brilliantly energetic flutes. So when and only when this programme is over, you can get your bank holiday Monday off to a shimmering start on Radio 3.
12 minutes to 9. Bookish rule hath pulled fair England down, says the Duke of York in Henry VI, Part 2. Shakespeare's version, Johnny. Bookish behaviour is a subject of a series chronicling the life of an antiquarian bookseller, Gabriel Book, as he solves crimes of plenty in London in 1946. The series has had some glowing reviews. It's called Bookish. And its writer, the actor Mark Gatiss, also stars in the show. It's back on You and Alibi, a British TV channel dedicated to crime drama. What is it about crime dramas that so excites the British public? Well, Mark is, of course, the writer and actor, not just of Bookish, but one of the League of Gentlemen, co-creator of Sherlock 2 and countless other great shows, frankly, and he joins us now. Mark, good morning.
Morning, how are you?
I'm fantastic. Very excited to read about this series and excited to watch it as well. Congratulations. What was it about London 1946 that so took your imagination?
Oh, well, it's a period I've always been fascinated by, and it's very under-examined. We're sort of obsessed with the war, and then the 50s sort of take over, but I've always had a thing about that post-war period.
Why?
And, Well, it's kind of, its reputation is very austere and grim, but to my teenage mind, it was all much more Powell and Pressburger than sort of austerity. So that was the sort of key to that.
It's a sort of birth of the modern England in some ways, modern Britain. Because
totally, it is. It's the foundations of the NHS. It's the most radical government we ever had. And that, weirdly, we don't talk about it much. So if you add murder into the mixture, then I think you're onto something.
Why? I was going to say, why when you're interested in a particular chapter in British history, a particular period, particularly a year, a particular moment, why would you examine it through the through a bookish, antiquarian solver of murder mysteries?
Why not? If I add to that. Yeah. Well, I've always loved, Golden Age detectives. I always wanted to play one. So the idea popped into my head a long time ago. This is the second series, as you say, and the response has been really terrific. And I think it's just an interesting vehicle to examine all kinds of things, really. You know, Book is a gay man in a lavender marriage with his childhood best friend, played by Polly Walker. And it's a very dangerous time to be a gay man, as it is today, to be a gay person. And so I think it's a sort of interesting lens to see it all through.
Of course, 20 years from, or roughly 20 years from the decriminalisation of homosexuality, of course, in this country. What did you mention sort of murder mysteries and crime. Did you watch a lot of them growing up? Did they sort of, as you were kind of developing as a writer?
I read. I was sort of brought up on Conan Doyle, obviously, and Agatha Christie. And I've just always loved the form. And now, obviously, we're in a kind of new golden age. We're awash with detectives. But I think it must say something very interesting about what's going on in people's minds. I think it's to do with order in a very chaotic world. I think something about the rules of detective fiction mean that, you know, people for 5 minutes or an hour, or when they sit by the pool with a paperback, they can still have a bit of order in their lives. I think that there must be something in that. And actually, just listening to that terrifying report about Ukraine, it makes you realise how vital books are, really. And to me, a huge part of the joy of this show is being able to communicate a simple and positive message, which is reading is good.
Yeah.
And actually, it's a sort of achievable power. You know, isn't a sort of detective who has a super impossible brain. He's a clever man, but he reads a lot, and that's not a bad message to have these days.
Yeah, well, we've tried very hard to champion reading on this on this program, that's for sure. Is it also that if you go down the route of Aristotle's Poetics, where you think it's about plot and character, a crime drama's necessarily got a fascinating plot because there's the jeopardy of the crime that you're trying to solve, and in terms of character, criminals just by their nature tend to be more interesting than witless bureaucrats.
Well, yes. I mean, every actor always says they prefer playing baddies, but it's the trick for me and all of us on the show is to try and ring the changes enough to make sure that you don't suspect them immediately. I mean, genuinely, one of the most difficult things about it is to leave enough clues so that you can play fair with the audience, but not make it so obvious that you can tell who the murderer is straight away.
Exactly. So some of our listeners won't know the channel You and Alibi. Just in case they're Googling it this morning, it's You, the letter U, and then ampersand capital A for Alibi. It's an unusual name for a channel. This is a channel dedicated to crime and crime drama. Is your show, Bookish, going to be out as an analogue programme in the streaming age, or is it sort of something you can get on demand as well?
It will be. I don't know. There are long-term plans, but as you know, the broadcasting environment is so fractured and different. Yeah. Those of us who grew up with analogue television, lots of people say to me, when's it on? And I sort of say, it's always on. It's always on now. And equally, it's quite difficult to point people in the direction of the channel. A lot of people have it and don't know they have it. Or, it's different to just saying it's on Wednesday at 8 o'clock like it used to be. Happily, people have found it, and that's the best thing.
They certainly have. Well, we wish you the best of luck with the series. Mark Gatiss, star, I think, of many programmes, but for today's context, Bookish, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
What a joy to have him on, a man with about 20 people's talent all wrapped up in one. It is 7 minutes to 9.
Now, do you remember when Saturday nights sounded like this? Yep, that's the sound of The X Factor, which, according to The Sun, on Sunday is coming back. They've tried a few different formats in recent years of TV bosses. This one's going to be another potentially quite loud and potentially quite interesting attempt at a return. Let's speak to two people who've thought hard about TV formats. Pete Waterman, who was a judge on Pop Idol and Pop Stars, The Rivals, of course, and Jordan Schwarzenberger, one of the most influential figures in our new media landscape as the co-founder of Arcade. That's the management company behind the YouTube giants, The Sidemen. Pete, Jordan, good morning.
Good morning.
Hello.
Pete, your instinctive reaction when you found the news, possibly from us, possibly from The Sun, that X Factor's coming back. What did you make of it, Pete?
I chuckled.
I'm not sure that's the response they wanted. We wanted a national moment of excitement at the return of this exhilarating format. They didn't necessarily want you to laugh. Why did you chuckle?
Because you can never say never in television, can you? I mean, you know, it's finished. This format's finished. I've heard that said so many times now. I chuckle every time I hear it. It'll never work again.
But is it finished?
No, of course it's not. They said that about, Carol Levis's Discovery show back in the 1950s. They discovered the Beatles, for God's sake.
What worked about the format? I mean, in its pomp, it was getting 10 million views. What worked about, not just X Factor, but the show that millions of people saw you on, Pete, which is this thing where people perform and then judges are sort of either nice or horrible to them?
Yeah, but the thing was the honesty and the new technology. I mean, the fact that they could vote for the first time straight away on a phone, that was completely new. The acts were part of it, but the excitement of sitting at home and going, well, she can't sing, and then the judges saying, well, sorry, love, you don't actually sing very well, that made them experts.
Yeah, and it was that sense of participation. Jordan, is Jordan, when it comes to these sort of ideas, is it about the idea or and the format, the content, or is it about where that content is shown to the viewer?
I think it's exactly the latter. I think it's not so much a problem with the format. And I actually agree with you, Pete. I think, you know, the format lasted for so many years and did so well because it is intrinsically really, really good and people love it. And that's why it did, you know, had so much legroom. But, you know, I think now it's about where it's shown. And if you look at the decline of linear TV specifically, something we've talked about a lot, you know, 75% decline over the last 10 years amongst that sort of core X Factor demographic, that's the fundamental problem. So trying to put it back on linear is not going to fix that existential decline, which is really a sort of product of the decentralization of media in general. People now have TikTok and YouTube and social in all sorts of forms, right? And globalized media. So it's very difficult to compete with that on linear.
Okay, well, Jordan, you've built through The Sidemen a huge, huge, huge modern media empire. For people that don't know, The Sidemen is a group of, I think, is it six or seven British guys? Six who've got this YouTube channel, and they've got spin-off businesses, they've got vodka things, they've got restaurant chains, all of that stuff. And it's often said that people under 35 or under 40 don't have the time to sit and watch an entire programme. Will X Factor at that length work if it's given to people where they want to watch it, Jordan?
Well, I mean, this is also one of the bigger myths, I think. I think it's not so much an attention span problem. I know, yes, everyone's been somewhat brain rotted by TikTok and short form. But if you look at Sidemen Sunday, for example, some of those episodes are 2 hours to 3 hours long, right? I mean, and plus a sort of bonus hour on Side Plus, which is their membership platform. So you have some people watching 4 hours of Sidemen content every Sunday night, sometimes more than that. So if you think about the attention span as being something that doesn't, I think, restrict itself to one format or another, it's more about, you know, are people engaged with the format and the show and the characters, then I think it could work.
You've got your own show, Jordan, called Think Like a Creator. It's a Substack as well. If you were within ITV right now and you had to approach this format as a creator rather than the sort of 20th century TV way, what should you be doing differently this time?
Yeah, well, I do think there is an existential problem around measuring linear views as the cornerstone of success for this. I think it should obviously be very social first. You should be looking at every platform. It should almost sit as an omni-channel IP, if you will, that sits across everywhere and reaches people where they are. I would then also be looking at clippers and having a strong sort of Gen Z, maybe 16-year-old edit team who are cutting up clips constantly, putting them out on various platforms, finding and also engineering in the show itself moments that have that potential to go viral and have those clips, but then also building around sort of characters and personalities that people really, really love in terms of the judges and who's, you know, who is the equivalent to an Anton Deck on BGT, who's equivalent for this new era, and how can they be that cornerstone of connection to the show?
Judges like Pete, if Kevin Ligo, the creative boss of ITV, called you up and said, Pete, would you come back and be a judge? What would you say?
Too old, mate. And listening to this young man here, I'm totally lost, because that's the problem. Everybody analyzes everything. You know what? There's nothing like a good program. I have heard so many times, drama will never work on television again. Bang, drama's back. British television, the Americans told us Pop Idol would never work in America. Fact.